Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
It's the Massapikalypse, the sequel. Construction to replace crumbling part of the Mass Turnpike near BU will mean fewer car lanes, compromised train travel on the Worcester Line, traffic headaches for everyone, but only for 8 to 10 years. We kick off Hour 1, taking your calls on all things transportation on our monthly edition of Road Rage. Then Sports Authority Trenton Kuznera joins us to talk about the Bruins making it to the Stanley Cup and how Ohio State University protected a team doctor for years as he went about sexually abusing scores of male athletes.
At noon, we talked to producer and director Michael Kirk about his new Frontline documentary, which looks at how the confirmation hearings of Robert Bork sparked a 30-year partisan war that's resulted in the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh and a much more conservative court. Then Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell joins us to talk about the Boston Public Schools, public safety, parking permit fees, and more. That's next on Boston Public Radio. Friday, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey,
oh,
there.
I forgot to say we're broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the Boston Public Library.
And you also forgot to say?
What did I say?
What time is it now?
It's a little bit after 11.
11:06. Marjorie left her house at 4 a.m. to get here this morning. Just got here 5 minutes ago. As you know, you'll understand the relevance of that in a minute. A hands-free driving bill is about to become law in Massachusetts. But why bother? I mean, we're really not driving anymore. Rather, we're usually inert, stuck in traffic. Our commutes are bad enough as is, and people are having to wake up earlier to get to work. But in 2022, things will get much worse when construction begins on the Mass Pike near BU. There'll be fewer turnpike lanes. The Worcester line will be compromised.
God.
The Department of Transportation may even have to build a roadway temporarily over the Charles River to make this work. The good news is it's only an 8 to 10-year project. We're taking
no
your
problem.
Calls, asking you if you're ready for the long haul, and I do mean long haul. Are you among those who are considering moving out of Massachusetts? Are you really reaching the breaking point? 877-301-8970. Marjorie reached the breaking point yesterday, actually, driving her son somewhere. What's that story, please?
Well, you know, it's so typical now where you just never know. And this is one of the points
never
of Beth Keitel's piece, when things are going to be totally busted up. One of the great things about the Big Dig, it enables you to get to the airport quickly. It enables you from the west to get to South Station quickly. But I do Waze, you know, the little thing on your phone.
Yes.
And it said the Mass Pike was all jammed up, so I should go through the city instead. Well, I live like 2 miles down Beacon Street from Fenway Park.
You
Everybody
do.
Knows where Fenway Park is.
Yes, we do.
I left my house at 10 minutes of 5 to get to South Station by 5:30.
40 minutes.
It normally takes 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so bad, we had to go through downtown, that my son got out and jogged.
That's not really
the train
true.
Station.
No, is that really true?
We sat right behind Chauncey Street on Tremont Street. Wait, before you take a left to get onto the next street, to that little tiny side street, we sat through three lights. I finally said, Dan, you'd be better off walking. And he was.
That part's true. I thought when you told me the story, you were making that part up. He
no,
literally walked or ran the rest of the way.
He did. He jogged. He got there faster, and I was still there just to see how long it was going to take me to get to South Station. I didn't get to South Station till 5:40. So it took me 50 minutes to get to South Station, and I just sat through life. I was like ready to burst. And all I could say is, you know, if you think it's bad now, wait till they mess up the Mass Pike and Storrow Drive and the Tobin Bridge and the commuter rail. I mean, it's unbelievable. You could say to yourself, well, I'll take the T. I've given up on driving. However, as we know, the shuttle buses had to replace the Red Line service this morning.
Why is that?
Because a train was derailed. And it derailed, I guess, about 5:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. They were still working on it 3 hours later at 8:25. Yeah. Now, I don't know if that means that they could be working faster, if that's how long it takes. There's no way anymore. You know what we're going to have to do, Jim?
No.
get on those little scooters.
I know you do.
That's the only thing we
now,
can do.
Now, the only good news out of your story is you're really calm and measured about it, which is really good. You know, if you read Beth Tytel's great piece today in the Globe, Boston
it's
traffic,
great.
The only predictable thing is that it's unpredictable. She uses a word that I think is now going to be integrated into everybody's vocabulary in Greater Boston. The word is cushion.
Cushion.
How much cushion do you put into your normal drive time? My favorite story that she tells, this one really shows how bad it is.
Yeah.
This person, Schwartz, who's some sort of consultant or something, describes a common scenario. I'm reading from Best Piece.
Yeah.
The road is full, but traffic is moving. When a driver, and here's the key word, almost spills his cup of coffee. Almost spills.
Almost.
And in the process of grabbing it, taps the brakes, triggering a chain reaction that slows the traffic from, say, 45 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour, causing a slowdown that can last for an entire morning commute.
Yeah.
You know, this is really, but let me tell you, hope is on the way, and I'll tell you why. This is, in my estimation, the way you get action from elected officials is if the thing on which you want action affects them. Well, the other day, Marjorie, since you just asked, mm-hmm. I had the House and Senate chairs of the legislature's transportation committees on. Bill Strauss is from Mattapoisett, which I love saying. He's the House
chair.
He's
got a long haul.
Yeah, well, it used to be an hour plus. Mm-hmm. You'll hear what it is now. And Senator Boncori, he's the Senate chair. He lives far away. That's in Winthrop, 6 miles from Beacon Hill. And I say to these guys, well, they were on, and I was asking them how long their commutes were. Here's what Representative Strauss and Senator Boncori had to say.
How long did it take you to get to work this morning from Mattapoisett?
2.5 hours.
How long?
Two and a half hours.
2.5 hours. How many miles is that?
54 miles.
How'd you feel during that commute?
Well, I promised myself years ago that I would never let the drive drive me crazy.
But?
It drove me crazy.
Okay, and you live in faraway Winthrop, which is what, a grand total of 6 miles? Is that what you told me?
6 miles away.
How'd you get to work today?
Today I drove.
And you usually take the T, right?
When I do take the T, it's 20 minutes.
How long did it take you to drive?
55.
Took the guy an hour to drive 6 minutes. The guy is the Senate Transportation Chair. 55 minutes to drive 6 miles and to drive 54 miles. And I think he told me it was like an hour. Ordinary had been from Mattapoisett an hour and 15, hour and 20. 2.5 hours. That leads me to conclude that they, both of whom think we need new taxes, even the governor's not there yet. The governor, by the way, will be with us at noon on Thursday. Obviously, this will be on the table for topics. Something's got to give, and something's got to give. And you know what the problem is? Even if it turns out, let's assume everybody's got an epiphany on Beacon Hill. We have a sense of urgency. We got to do it now.
Which we don't have.
Charlie Baker says, I'm joining the Democrats. No matter what they decide, I'm going to sign on to it. It isn't like it's going to be fixed tomorrow. It isn't like it'll be fixed next year, even if they decided to appropriate a ton of money. And Baker brags, as well he should, it's apparently the largest capital spending thing, what, $8 billion over 5 years on the T. But that's not going to change anything in the short run. In the short run, we are on our way. By the way, my apologies, Governor Baker's 1 o'clock on
1 o'clock.
Thursday,
okay.
Not 2 o'clock. And the mayor, by the way, I didn't know this either. Thank you, Chelsea. The mayor is here Friday at 12:15. So tomorrow we have the governor of Rhode Island. It'll probably take her 10 hours to drive here. Governor Baker will be with us on Thursday at 1, and the mayor will be with us Friday at 12:15. So I assume this topic will be broached with all
three of
these people.
You know, as Beth Tytel points out in her Globe story, too, you have to really be abreast of the college and universities this time
Excellent
of year,
point.
Their graduation
Excellent
schedules
point.
Or their class day schedules, because if you happened on Sunday to be driving down Star Drive or even Memorial Drive, which is across the river, and you forgot that it was BU's graduation, I mean, forget it. You were just not getting home. So you better be up to date on what Northeastern's doing. BU, Harvard's in June. You got a couple of weeks to prepare for all the mess that Harvard's going to cause. All these schools, Boston College, they graduated on Monday. It was a mess up that way.
Can I give
Huge
advice,
signs
though?
On the highway.
I'm sorry, you're far too alarmist. I'm serious. Can I give a more measured kind of response?
Yes, Jim.
You're talking about these graduations. Mm-hmm. Here's my advice. Mm-hmm. If your son or daughter is, let's say, I don't know, a junior at BC, leave now. That's essentially what my advice is. 877-301-8970.
They get this poor kid in East Boston who has to get up at 5:30 in the morning to leave at 6 to try to get to school at 7:20. Now, I don't know why they're starting classes at Boston Latin County at 7:20 in the morning. Must be a teacher's rule union, Jim.
I'm sure it is.
Teacher's union rule,
whatever it is.
Anyway, But she says, what am I going to do? I figure that's enough time. We leave at 6, an hour and 20 minutes to get from East Boston to Boston Latin County. But indeed, it's not always enough time. Down at Mass General, they're talking about 20% of the patients are showing up late because of traffic problems.
Can I say
it's just crazy.
One last thing about this, then we'll get to your phone calls. It's not just the cushion and how late you are for things and how much out of your life, how much time you have to spend. Remember, we did this a month or two ago when that group, that survey group said we have the single worst commute of anywhere in the country. The other, thank you, Ron. Ron, our coworker, is kind enough to bring us a little Newsfeed Cafe action. Thank you, Ron. The issue to me, and this is what I feel, I'm not caught in it as much as the average commuter is the issue for me is what Chairman Strauss just said. He says, I promised myself years ago I wouldn't let the drive drive me crazy, but it has. When I am caught in traffic, which is maybe once a week, because I have this very short commute from Cambridge to Brighton and back to work here, the psychological pain it causes is immense. You feel like your head is going to pop off your shoulders.
But you know what the issue is? The issue is there's no alternative. That's the problem.
That's true. That's true.
If you thought the MBTA was reliable, look at all these people on the red line now. You know, massive delays this morning in shuttle buses. And let me tell you something, those shuttle buses are going like 5 miles an hour down the road. If you had another way to do it. So either we're all going to start bike riding or doing those scooters you see every place now. I just don't know what the...
Well, the one alternative, actually, I'm not a transportation expert, as you often make that comment about yourself.
Yes.
I'm not a transportation expert. What I would have done, and I don't mean to insult the governor, after the Red Line train derailed this morning, I just keep driving it. I mean, just keep going. It's off the rails, but you got to get where you got to go. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Worcester with Paul. Paul, you've been very patient. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Marjorie and Jim.
Hey. Hi.
I keep a cushion in my car for taking a nap while sitting in traffic.
It's another kind of cushion. Exactly.
Bad idea.
How bad is it for you, Paul?
Well, I actually tend not to drive. I wanted to talk about the train, if that's okay. There's
sure, of course. Absolutely.
I took the train from Worcester to see the Ebonic Woman on Sunday.
Oh, did you have a good time?
What'd you think?
It was stupendous. Fabulous. If you can't have fun there, you can't have fun anywhere.
By the way, that is Ryan Landry's latest. That was an unsolicited recommendation from Paul from Worcester. Paul, we'll pass it along to Ryan. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Paul.
Anyway, there's a $10 weekend unlimited pass that I heard about a year ago. I heard about it a year ago once, and it was a summer thing. I didn't know it was still going on until I looked at the machine, and it said, it was a handwritten sign. It was written by the cop at Worcester Station. It said, you can get the thing for $10, and it's on a train with a credit card. I foolishly used my app to buy a $23 ticket.
Oh, God.
And there was nothing on the app. There was nothing on the website when I was looking for the routes and the times. There was nothing else that told me there was a $10 ticket. The other thing is the bathrooms are horrific. I didn't need to use it, but, you know, it's an 80-minute train ride. A lot of people did, and I don't understand why they can't, when they get to the station, they can't just empty the tank or do something to at least make it usable for that 80-minute train ride.
That's awful.
That's awful.
Well, thanks for the call. And again, Brian's going to love your review. Thank you.
The bathrooms were so clogged you couldn't use them? Or they were just so dirty and gross?
I asked the conductor, is there a bathroom? And he said, you do not want to go in there ever.
That's nice.
Boy.
Okay, well, that's good. Thank you, Paul, for starting us off. 877-301-8970. How do you like that the sign was handwritten saying that there are those unlimited, whatever it is, weekend tickets for $10?
Yeah,
you know what's unbelievable about this, by the way?
What?
Is that is there ever been a need in that state government has to deal with that is clearer than this one?
No.
I mean, there's nobody on the other side of this issue. There may be funding disputes. Everybody knows how horrible this thing is. So just do something.
Okay, and this Mass Pike situation is going to last 8 to 10 years.
It's
going to be really swell. Mm-hmm. They're considering, you know, how to mitigate the situation. They're considering reducing the number of turnpike lanes. I'm sure that's going to work well since the turnpike is bumper to bumper. Mm-hmm. Incredible. And even on the weekends, you don't understand where are people going. Or they're going to eliminate 2 commuter trail racks in the Worcester line. That'll be good for Paul there. Or they're going to build a roadway out over the Charles River.
Well, that'd be a temporary thing, yeah.
Now, what does that mean? We're going to have a roadway above the Charles River?
That's what they just
over
read. Over
implies
yeah.
over.
Over, yeah. Exactly.
I don't understand what that means. But they do concede that no matter what they do, the impact on commuters will be, quote, unquote, severe.
Yeah, I think it
will
be.
For 8 to 10 years.
877-301.
You know, when I was a kid, I remember reading a story in Time Magazine or Newsweek or something, how, you know, by the year 1995, we were all going to have jetpacks.
Jetpacks, like, I remember that.
And we could be like the Jetsons.
Right, exactly.
That cartoon show.
We
could
fly to
fly.
Work.
Yeah. Somebody should get to work on that, Jim.
Yeah.
I can see you.
I have somebody working
in.
On that. Yeah, I do. I have somebody Cambridge. Working on that. You know what people are talking about is like suspending themselves from drones. Just getting a drone.
That's right.
Hang on
get the
and
heavy,
try, hope for the best.
Get the big boy drone.
The best
come
drone.
Right over the river.
Debbie, you're in Bridgewater. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hello. I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
I'm a retired teacher from Taunton, and I'm happy I have never had to commute.
Mm-hmm.
But I know my daughter tried so hard to use the bus, to use the train. It was so, from Bridgewater to the city, it was so expensive.
How much is it? I don't even know.
You know, I've now that I'm retired, I don't have to think so much.
Yeah.
So I don't really know, but it's
a lot of money.
Expensive.
Okay.
Yep. And my heart goes out to people that have to do this day in and day out. Young parents that are trying to get home.
Oh. Daycare. It's crucial. Your dollar minute. Like if you're late for daycare,
I remember
right?
That,
I
mean,
remember how
when
much
traffic was a lot better.
A fortune.
Yes, it's just, and sometimes they close, so one or the other has to leave
That's
their
right.
job. And I get that the children are more important than the job.
No, they have to leave the babies right in the curbside there.
Fuel the family. Yes, yes. So anyway, that's just my take. And I will tell you, my daughter and I took a day off and went to visit you folks at the library.
Oh,
great.
Debbie.
Oh, thank you so much.
I hope you had fun. We love when people come by. Debbie, thank you so much. 877-301-897. I want to refocus on the point I made before.
What was your point, Jim?
The psychological impact of this. Maybe if you commute every day, you begin, because I don't. Well, I do, but it's very short because I live, you know, just a few minutes away from work. Maybe if you do it every day, it's sort of so integrated into your system that you're not ready to go nuts. And maybe it only happens to people like me who get stuck, as I say, once a week. But I'm not exaggerating. For radio purposes, it really, you feel the frustration level you feel becomes like a physical feeling in your body.
A good thing
like you can't take it anymore.
Audiobooks. Imagine how many books people have read in this Commonwealth of Massachusetts sitting in traffic where they can't get anywhere.
Well, if you're calm enough to do that.
Robert is really concerned because he lives in Arlington, and his cemetery plot for the future time is at Mount Auburn Cemetery. But he says, do you think I should leave now because I don't want to miss my own funeral? I don't know, Robert.
It's not funny.
I can't advise you. But you might, you know, just to be on the safe side.
Have you noticed, I mean, this is unscientific, it's gotten worse and worse and worse, has it not?
It has.
In a very short period of
time. Well, lots of people are complaining about Uber and Lyft. Not only that they stop in the middle of the road when they're inside the city.
That's a good point.
What is there, 60 to 90,000?
96,000 trips a day in Boston.
That's a lot.
Not greater Boston, in Boston, 96,000 a day.
Yeah, they're making things worse.
Okay, let's take another call. You pick this one, Marjorie.
Okay, let's go to Alan in Middleborough. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Alan.
Hi, how you doing today?
We're
good.
Excellent, as you can tell. Go ahead.
Good.
I'm
from down on the South Shore near where Rep Strauss lives. I'm in Middleborough. He's in Mattapoisett. He's a big fan of the South Coast Rail proposal. He said his ride takes him about 2 hours to get into Boston. The proposal for the South Coast Rail from Fall River and New Bedford, that's going to take an hour and a half, and that's from platform to platform if everything works well.
Uh-huh.
You add 15 minutes on each end of that to get from your house to the platform and then from South Station to wherever you're working. That's a two-hour ride.
So what's your point?
The solutions they're coming up with are just as bad as the problem.
Well, except let me just say, this gets back to my thing, Alan, about the psychological stress. I would say if you knew in advance that how long your commute was going to take, and the assumption is on the train, if it runs efficiently, I know it's a big if, you're going to know, number one, that's a huge plus. And number two, if you're not driving and you're not responsible for the commute, but you're sitting in a seat, you can do in a semi-relaxed way whatever you want to do. Listen to the audiobook.
Well, you
listen
can get
to
work
music,
done.
A podcast, do work, whatever you want to do. So I hear you in terms of time, but I'll tell you, I would bet that most people listening, if they had a choice between driving in bumper-to-bumper traffic for 2 hours or taking an on-time, I know, again, big if, on-time commuter rail, they'd opt for the South Coast Rail. So I hope it happens, Alan, but thank you for your opinion.
Of course, you know, Alan raises a great point,
What's
that? Almost every other country in the developed world has something called high-speed rail. So we foolish Americans sit here and put up with this while people are going from Boston to New York, the equivalent, in what, an hour and a half, 2 hours, something
like
that?
Do you remember, we had Richie Neal, Congressman Neal, on with us a couple of months ago, weeks ago, from Springfield, who is arguably the single most important person in Congress when it comes to finances. He's been lobbying for years for East-West rail thing being more efficient, sped up. Do you remember when I said to him on the phone, again, whenever we talked to him a couple of weeks ago, you're looking for high-speed rail? And he stopped me and he said, not high-speed rail. Something, his response was, higher-speed rail. So that's not even our aspiration.
Yeah, it's not even our aspiration. You know, you sometimes wonder when, if we ever are going to wake up.
We're not.
You know?
We're not.
We have lousy infrastructure.
We do.
Lousy transportation.
Lousy.
We're all spending a fortune on gas, repairs to our cars. Yeah. I hit a pothole. I had to get two new tires. I was
that's
ready
horrible.
To shoot myself.
I bet you
we have the, we pay more for prescription drugs and healthcare than anybody in the world.
Yep.
We have no child care. All these situations. It's like everybody else has moved on, and the Americans, the supposedly smartest and richest nation on the earth, is like, it just
But at least
wants
it's trending in the right direction.
Is it trending in the right direction, Jim?
No,
I'm
actually,
not sure. Anyway, we're talking about our traffic woes, asking you, what is your coping mechanism? How do you pace your road rage? That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, I guess this has become our monthly edition of Road Rage. We're opening the lines, taking your calls on the T, congested commutes, your solutions. You know, actually, rather than whine, which is what all we've done for the first 20 minutes, the point you made just before we took a break there, what are your coping? I'd be interested to know, what are people's coping mechanisms? Because the reality is it's not getting better anytime soon. So since it's not getting better anytime soon, hopefully it's going to get a lot better.
It's infrastructure week,
though.
You know that? It's infrastructure week.
I thought it was last week.
Maybe it was last week.
Whatever.
What has happened during infrastructure
week? A lot. It's incredible. It is amazing how well that went.
I mean, how many people do have ruined tires because of potholes?
Isn't ruined tires. Marjorie, a couple of weeks ago, we learned, months ago, whatever it was, we have the worst commute in the United States of America.
I
Not
know.
Bad.
Remember we used
the
to make
worst
fun
in the United States
We used to make
America.
Fun of the Californians saying how horrible
yes,
it would be to
I
drive into Los Angeles.
I do.
And they don't have any public transportation system. Now here we are. We've surpassed them already. It's really quite, it's kind of depressing.
It is?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay.
Anyway, let's go to Gary from Winthrop. Ooh. Gary from Winthrop, you can talk about trying to get into Boston from Winthrop. How brutal is it, Gary?
Hi, Gary.
To tell you the truth, I'm going to advocate for a biker, and I take my car sometimes, I take my bike sometimes. And my bike, if I put it on the train at East Boston, I'm in Bowdoin in 15, 20 minutes.
Mm.
I go from there with the bike pretty easy. For every person that's on a bike, you've got one less car, I stop it, right?
Yeah, and you see all the people on the bikes and the scooters when you're sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic, as I was yesterday for 50 minutes trying to get to South Station, which usually takes 15 minutes, you realize that the people in the cars are really the fools because the people in the bikes are speeding right by you. The problem, of course, is I'm afraid of getting hit by a car on the bike because I'm so close to the cars on the bike. You know what I mean, Gary? Doesn't it make you a little nervous sometimes?
Yeah, well Marjorie, I lived for 2 years in Denmark, and from grandmothers to young kids, everybody's on a bike. You know, the reason why it's safe, they have dedicated a bicycle lane outside of the outside of the truck.
Yeah.
And the other point I'd like to make is, you know, for people complaining, well, I can't get to work because I'll be all sweaty because I'm on a bike and blah blah blah. Well, for about a couple hundred dollars extra, you can buy an e-bike and
buy a what?
Yeah.
What do you buy?
You can buy an e-bike. It has electric boost on it, so you don't even have to pedal if you.
So wow.
Hey, Gary, this is a rotten connection.
That is a rotten connection.
No, but thank you for your call. An e-bike, he said. An e-bike.
I didn't even know there was such a thing.
Well, now you do.
Yeah.
For a couple $100.
That's another thing. Can we have dedicated bike lanes?
Well, they are increasing those. I mean, we can talk
really,
to Mayor Walsh about
really
that on Friday.
They're increasing at a rapid pace, aren't they?
Some they are. Maybe not as quickly as we'd like. Let's go to Providence, where Chris is on the phone. Chris, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hello. Long-time listener, many-time caller, first-time getting in.
Whoa, great. We love that. Welcome.
In Massachusetts. Thank you. And whenever I hear you're from Fall River, I feel a kindred spirit.
Oh, good.
As I grew up in New Bedford.
yeah, very kindred. Yes. Although you've kind of left us in the dust over there in New Bedford, Chris. I get upset. You know, things are picking up in New Bedford, I think, aren't they?
Yes. Very exciting.
Yeah.
Of course.
By the way, the other plus, I mean, if I just may say about New Bedford, which is a small advantage, their mayor, who we had breakfast with a few months ago, Mayor Mitchell, hasn't even been indicted for anything, unlike Fall Rivers. So that's a huge asset, I would say, as far as we know, anyway.
I know.
Right.
But go ahead, Chris. You called. What's up?
Well, I do love to, when I do need to take the train for work, I do love to take the train. To your point, Jim, you do get to check out. You do get to listen to podcasts. Mm-hmm. You get to do work on your way there. You get to button up some things on the way back. However, the train itself, the physical train, when that caller from Worcester, and I can't believe the one chance I've had so many things that I've wanted to call in about, and this is what I get to call in about, but hear me out.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about the restroom being unusable.
Yep.
Well, this summer, I was very pregnant, and I went to use the restroom, as one does in an emergency when they are very pregnant. And the bathroom was unusable to the point where I actually approached a conductor working on the train. And I had asked them, is there any way or is there another restroom? They said no. Then I asked, okay, is there a chance that somebody would be able to rectify the situation in that bathroom? And they said, absolutely not.
Oh, my God.
So I had to wait until I got to Back Bay, where I ran off the train, ran up the escalator, and to the restroom immediately. But to my point is, while I enjoy taking the train, the actual facilities are so poorly maintained that I can see how it can turn some people off. And, again, that Worcester caller, I'm with you.
What line was that,
yeah,
Chris? Say again.
The commuter rail?
What line was that?
On the commuter rail.
On the commuter rail.
Now, you say to yourself, there's no reason for that. Amtrak, which, doesn't have the best restaurant or anything, they run out of food all the time. The bathrooms on Amtrak are well-maintained. So why can't they maintain the commuter rail?
Let's ask the governor that. Hey, Chris, before you go away, we have your governor, Raimondo, with us tomorrow. How's the traffic in
Gina.
How's the traffic in Providence?
Well, when you commute to Boston, you get the pleasure of the Rhode Island traffic and the Boston traffic. But if you're commuting into Massachusetts, that is, I will say it can be rough. but it's all smaller scale, so it's a shorter distance. But it can absolutely be rough, and you are bumper to bumper, and you just can't wait to get to where you're going. But it's nothing. There is literally nothing that compares to 93 into Boston. It knows no equal.
Chris, we're really glad you got through finally. Thank you much for the call. We really appreciate it.
That's really horrible.
Horrible. Horrible.
Remember a couple of years ago we talked about someone called about the restrooms in Massachusetts, how they close
on
early.
The turnpike, on the highway.
And the highways. And so you get into Connecticut and they're open 24 hours and they're well-maintained. I mean,
but wait a second. On the turnpike, aren't the service, whatever they're called, they're open 24 hours, aren't they?
Well, I think if you go to a place with a gas station or something, you know, that like if you are on 24 South and it's got the gas station, it's got the convenience store and stuff like that. But there are these rest stops, these that aren't gas stations. Mm-hmm. They're rest areas with bathrooms.
Someone called for the governor on that.
Yes.
We
should ask them about that. That's improved because, I mean, how much... Is that expensive? Is that too much to ask?
So before we end this, Road Rage essentially has become a monthly feature on Boston Public Radio, unfortunately. Is that where we are?
Well, I think the Best Hotels thing hits the nail on the head.
It does.
That traffic has become totally unpredictable. That the ride, you think, for example, in rush hour.
You don't think it's predictably bad?
Yes, but I think it's like yesterday, like I said, normally it takes 15 minutes to get from my house to South Station on the Turnpike.
Yeah.
But so you allow an extra 20 minutes because it's rush hour, and then it takes you, instead of taking you 50 minutes plus the 20 minutes, what's that, 35 minutes? It took me 50 minutes.
Yeah, your kid just emailed, by the way. He's walking to New York, and he says, what does it say? Mom, I'll be there in an hour. So he said he'll call you at the end of the show.
All right. Coming up, we talked with Sports Authority Trenti Kuznarek for a bunch of stuff going on in sports, which the latest with Robert Kraft and a bunch of other things. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of sports and society is Trenti Kuznarek. Trenti's an anchor, reporter for NBC Sports Boston, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Trenti Kuznarek.
Hi, guys.
Okay, we were hearing off air about Trenti's marathon over the weekend. The details sound a little gruesome, but you have qualified for the Boston Marathon.
I qualified under the new standards.
Which
I'm
is
very
pretty
excited about
impressive.
That.
What is it, 3:30?
No, I need a 3:40 because I'm 42, and I ran a 3:35:53. So I gave myself 4 minutes and 7 seconds of pad, which I'm guessing should be enough under the new standards.
And you were in pouring rain for much of the race.
Yeah,
and
like
cold.
Probably the last 15 miles were rain and about 47 degrees. And I usually don't run well. Like anything that's humid, even if it's cold, I struggle in just because I, for whatever reason, my body reacts adversely to it. So that's the fastest time I've ever run in bad conditions, which tells
good
me that if I have
you.
Good conditions, I can maybe run faster.
So,
good
Marjorie, now that she's qualified for Boston, she and I will both be running. If you can run all three of
us. Wait, yeah. You're going to run Boston?
No, I'm not. Wanted to see if you'd fall for that.
Well, you can run for charity.
How excited were you? Thank you for that. How excited were you when you qualified? It's pretty great, right?
It was pretty great. I mean, I was kind of out of it. I crossed the finish line and I looked at, you know, the people who give you like the wraps and stuff, and I was like, I'm so cold. She's like, okay, let's get you. And they gave me like two of the foil things. And then I'm standing in line and I'm talking to these girls, and all of a sudden my calves seized up, and I was like, I'm cramping. And I'm like, I swear I'm not making this up so that I can skip you in the massage line. And a doctor comes over and looks at me, and he's like, okay. Two man and a woman, they're like, okay, you look like you're a little cold, and we have some cramps. They're like feeding me bananas, and then they come back, and the doctor says to me, oh, you're not blue anymore. Okay, good. That's a good sign. I'm like, oh, great.
Post-blue.
So I spent some time in a warming, but much better than Chicago, where I was cramping like 16 miles in and had to walk the last 8 miles, and then spent 2.5 hours in a medical tent. This time I just needed to get a little.
So NBC Sports Boston is not going to make you wear like a GoPro or something for this. You're just going to run
the race. I'm not going to be slowed down by extra equipment.
Well, congratulations. That is
Thanks.
Really
it is great.
Spectacular.
It really is exciting.
I mean, to be able to run Boston with a number is really great.
Yeah, I was pretty excited.
Yeah.
Now,
one of my biggest regrets in my whole life.
What's that? Oh, you didn't run Boston?
Getting a number and then never running.
Oh, wait a second. I didn't know you got a number. You qualified?
I told you that a million times.
From your Burlington?
You really do never listen to Marjorie.
I
never listens to Marjorie.
I
when I came in third in the Lake Champlain
Well,
Island
how many women were running?
Well, there were only three women. So.
Exactly. So.
I know. I took 10th in my age group, and I was like, oh, that's awesome, except for that there was only like, there wasn't that many women,
well,
I don't think,
still,
in my age
100?
Group, but I'll take
that's
it.
Still good?
There's
yeah.
probably more than 100, but I'm not 100% sure on the numbers, but I was like, I'm going to take it. Although I looked at the chimes of the women who were at the top, and I was like, damn it. It would have been a perfect day, and I could have run what I think I was capable of. I'm like, I would have made the podium.
Well, you might have made the podium. You might have made the podium. But the thing is, you're going to run with the number, which I think is so great because it's really hard to do. You've got to really be trucking for 26 miles to get
and these
to
are
get
all
a number.
The new, and these are the new standards, too. So I was really happy. I mean, like I've said before, and I think on this show, the number that I've needed to qualify for Boston has not changed since I was 27 years old, and I'm 42 now. Like, at this point, if the numbers were still the same when I was 27, I would have needed 3 hours and 50 minutes to qualify. Like, it would have been a breeze to qualify. But now I need 3 hours and 40 minutes, which is what I've needed my entire time I've been running. I thought getting older was supposed to be better.
So, Trenny, the Bruins are in the Stanley Cup Finals.
They are.
And what Marjorie is too shy to ask, but I'll ask for her. She asked me before the show started. Could you break down the third line play for us?
No.
For her, please. Is that possible?
No.
Okay, fine.
I will tell you that the Bruins' depth is one of their biggest strengths, is that they do get production and goal production from their third and fourth lines, which a lot of other teams do not. So they don't have to always rely on their top lines. That's about as far as I can go. If you want a hockey breakdown, we're going to have to call my colleague Joe Haggerty or DJ B.
Okay, so here's a quiz for you, Marjorie.
Jim, I don't know anything about the Bruins.
Well, I don't care whether.
I know that they're in the Stanley Cup Finals. I know they have to wait a week to play. They're not playing this week. They have to wait till next week.
Okay, here's a quiz. Yes. I don't care whether you want to take it or not. Here it is. What does it mean for a goalie to stand on his head? What does that mean, please? Marjorie Egan, you have 10 seconds.
I have no idea.
Trenny Kazarek, please fill in the blank.
When a goalie stands on his head, it means he makes incredible saves and goes above and beyond the normal call of duty. And usually it means that he sort of helps the team win the game. Like he's standing on his head in order to get them the win, which Tuukka Rask has done in the postseason thus far.
It's not a literal.
It's not a literal standing on his head.
Difficult to do on the ice.
Very hard to do one on the ice and two to then stop pucks that are flying at you like at 100 miles.
Okay, I don't know much more than Marjorie does to tell the truth. So in the spirit of
disclosure, they'll either play St. Louis or San Jose. They have game 6 this evening with St. Louis leading 3-2.
Okay, but here's my question. Even if you're a lot more expert than we are, obviously. Doesn't the team with the best goalie always win?
It's certainly helpful. Usually the goalie who is the hottest, and I don't mean that in terms of like, wow, you're really good looking. I mean the hottest in terms of goals against average and save percentage is usually the team that wins because it's the last line of defense, right? So even if your offense is scoring at will, if your goalie is letting, you know, pucks, you know, into the net at a high rate, it's You know, there's only so many goals to go around in hockey. So the hottest goalie, the team with the best goalie usually wins.
So we can assume that those Russian goalies, when Vladimir Putin is out there scoring those goals, awful.
Yeah. Or maybe
really
just
terrible.
Really like life and don't want to go.
Exactly.
Maybe not a fan of Siberia in the winter. That's my guess. Did you watch that video finally?
Which one?
The one of Vladimir Putin.
Oh, him doing the
falling.
Face plant?
Yeah.
No, I forgot.
Jeez, Jim.
But can I tell you what I did watch? I've said this before on the air, but I feel I have to say this now yet again. Because it sounds like I'm disparaging the sport. I've been to one Bruins game in my whole life with my kid, the guy who's cut my hair for 30 years, and his kid. And because it was a former sponsor of ours who was kind enough to give us tickets, we got to sit right on the glass. It was maybe the most exciting sporting event I have seen.
Hockey in person is so different than TV.
I can't skate. I'm not interested in the sport. It was so wildly exciting. It was amazing. The speed and the... It was unbelievable.
It is the one sport where I feel like it just doesn't quite translate on TV.
I think that has been my experience.
Like, I'd rather watch football on TV. Like, football in a stadium to me is boring. Like,
I
can't see replays. There's so much time in between plays. It's cold. People are drunk and they're miserable, even if they're winning.
Yeah.
And at home, you know, you can flip back and forth. Again, you can see replays. You can watch, like, the analysts break things down. But hockey, you just don't really get a sense of how finely skilled the athletes are until you see it in person.
How fast
the game is.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's unbelievably fast.
So
now,
do you know
fast those pucks, as you said, 100 miles an hour.
Do you know how much tickets are going for? So I was talking to a neighbor in my neighborhood. That's what makes someone a neighbor.
Yes.
A guy in my neighborhood yesterday, and he was saying they were looking at loge-level seats are like $500 a... No.
Really?
The balcony seats are $500 a pop, and like loge level or something are like $2,800.
Wait, sold by the Bruins?
I think this is
resell.
Like face value, he said.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, what happened to hockey being the working man's sport? Who can afford a $2,800? I might be wrong. I should probably double check that.
We don't
but
care if you're wrong.
You don't care. Okay, good.
They're very expensive.
It is very expensive to see playoff hockey, though.
Okay.
By the way, they have another player, another nice thing, a la Brady.
Yes,
who
is Daniel
really old. He's in his 40s, is he
easy
not?
With the really old.
Well,
he's 42.
I mean old for the sport.
Exactly.
Oops. But he's, yes. I mean, that's great too. Okay, yes. I'm sorry, Bob Kraft, Robert Kraft.
Yeah, the NFL owners are all meeting tonight. What's this going to mean for Robert Kraft?
Yeah, I think their meetings actually start tomorrow, the owners' meetings in like Jacksonville or Miami or something. Probably right now, nothing.
Yeah.
Everything I've read today in the article that Chelsea sent me yesterday on this, it doesn't look like they're going to make a decision on Robert Kraft and whether or not he'll face any disciplinary measures for the incident at the Orchids of Asia Spa. It's sort of a wait and see approach. I think they're taking their time, see what happened. What bothered me though, as I read the article about it, is there was, you know, an unnamed owner was quoted as saying, "Well, you know, most people would like to see him face some disciplinary action, but if he shows that he's contrite and does some philanthropic work, we might be, you know, maybe he won't face any you know, further discipline." And I thought, oh, so if you throw money at the problem, like, again, if you're a billionaire and you do something that's wrong and that really goes against the what the NFL says is sort of a moral code, well, as long as you have money and you can give and give back to charity after you have solicited a prostitute, we'll look the other way. Like, I think that's BS. I hope that that doesn't happen. I really do hope he faces some sort of discipline, because whether or not, you know, this... it's possible maybe that the charges are dropped, or we'll see what happens with the video, you know, now being barred from being able to be used in the court, even upon appeal. None of that takes away from the fact that he visited multiple times and there is video of him getting being serviced sexually by a prostitute. This isn't a one. It really bothers me how we've somehow decided that this is okay and it's not that big of a deal and he's just an old guy looking for some fun. I know too much and have read too much about women who are sold into and forced into prostitution. There were women living at this place when they went in. So whether or not, and the idea that he didn't know, okay, maybe you didn't know the first time, but you knew the second time and you went back.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. So after the first time, and by the way, newsflash, everybody, if you go in to get a massage at the Asia of Orchid Spa, one, you're a rich guy. You're not going to get a massage in a strip mall because you think it's a good massage. So there, I don't buy that excuse. And two, if you go in the first time and you really do go in for just a massage and the girl reaches around to give you a little extra, you know what you do? Please don't do that. Stop. There is, by the way, I know this is hard for a lot of people to wrap their brain around, but you are able to say, no, that is not okay. I do not want to participate in this.
I agree with everything you said with one exception. I don't think you should be able to
say no.
No, I don't think you should be able to buy your way out of a penalty if a penalty is legitimate. But I think if a guy shows true contrition...
How do you know if he has contrition?
Wait, let me finish a sentence.
By how he's approached this
legally, he hasn't. If a person shows true contrition and takes affirmative acts, let's say philanthropic ones, and I agree, it's a lot easier when you're loaded, that should be relevant to the punishment. I'm not saying it should eradicate the punishment.
So, right. I mean, if it is part of the punishment, right? Like, how many people who have first offenses, part of their punishment is community service, a number of hours. Like, I'm not against that, but this to me sounds more like he could evade any punishment.
Well, that I agree.
Wait a minute. How do you show true contrition if you haven't pled guilty?
Well, he did. Firstly, again, we've had this discussion. The I'm truly sorry thing, without saying what he was truly sorry about in the one statement, was not enough. It was a start. All I'm saying is, if prior to the NFL's decision here, whatever the decision is, he shows what normal people would consider to be contrition and actions, affirmative actions. So let me just finish the thought. You don't think that's relevant to what his penalty is?
I think
if they're going to bet, let's say for argument's sake, he was going to suspend him, Goodell was going to suspend him, I'm making this up, for 8 games. That's not relevant to whether or not it should be 6 games or 5 games.
I think it is. On this, normal people have a misconception about prostitution, and they think normal people, most of them think that this is a victimless crime and it's not a big deal.
I'm not disagreeing with you. The question is, what's the ultimate league punishment in a league that is totally screwed up?
I don't know what the punishment is. All I know is that he knew all about sex trade because he had those women from My Choice, My Life, My Choice, whatever it is, that group that talks about the exploitation of these women. He gave money to them already.
He knows
all about this already. So I don't know what his punishment should be. All I know is that saying I'm sorry and having contrition doesn't jive with how he's conducting
should
himself.
Should it mitigate his punishment if he shows what you consider to be true
What's
contrition?
Contrition?
I don't know. How do you ever decide if someone's sincere?
To everybody except the women
Correct.
In the spa.
Correct. And let's assume he does after his case is dismissed or adjudicated. That's
Here's the thing. I don't know that we'll ever know that because I think he would want to keep it private because that in and of itself, I think in his mind, would link him to being guilty, and he has continued to feign
innocence.
Well,
he admitted he was guilty when he said, I'm truly sorry, even though he didn't fill in the blanks. I mean, isn't that... I mean, that is a non-legal admission of guilt, at least as far... I want to be clear here so I don't get angry email. I am not in any way downplaying the seriousness of the trade.
Multiple lawyers fighting this on every front.
I agree, including a lawyer for one of the most disgusting people who ever lived, Jeffrey Epstein. I'm not quarreling
I would say that does not show contrition or making amends.
But in any case, we'll find
out. It shows basically that, again, if you have money and power, you can buy your way out of anything.
Yeah.
We're talking to Trini Kuznarek. Ohio State, we've talked a lot about Nassar. Is that his name?
Yep,
the
Larry
Michigan
Nassar.
State
yep.
guy.
Exactly.
So the story in the New York Times, Ohio State finds team doctors, Dr. Strauss, who killed himself in 2005, sexually abused 177 men there. And this profound apology from the president of Ohio State, but it's clear from everything I've read, this is yet another cover-up. Like, tons
yes.
of people in the infrastructure of the university knew it. And as far as I'm concerned, the jury is still out on whether or not this Congressman Jim Jordan,
oh,
who
I know.
Claimed vindication, whether he knew what was going on, even though he denies it. You know, what this kind of story leads me to conclude? This is sort of like when we talked about the college admission scandal, another shoe drops every day. This is going on in a ton of places. The shoe just hasn't dropped there. Michigan State, Ohio State, these high-end...
Penn State.
What? And
Don't
forget
obviously
about Penn
State.
So the assumption is, ultimately, there are going to be more and more and more once all the facts get out.
And what bothers me about this is Ohio State finds that he abused, 177 men during this period, I think from like the 1960s through 1996. Oh, you find it now? But if you actually read the evidence, now I will say this, the current president at Ohio State, I don't believe was not the president during the time that any of this happened. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that the current leadership at Ohio State is at fault for this. But according to the victims and the statements and everything you read, coaches, trainers, administrators, once again, were made aware of what this man was doing to young men who were going to Ohio State, whose parents entrusted these sports programs and doctors for decades, not for a couple of years, for three
More than 50
decades.
Athletic department staff members, the report suggests, knew.
And now you find, let's see, 2005 to 2019, 14 years after this man kills himself, now you admit and say, it means to me that means nothing to the victims. I'm sure they'll get some sort of monetary settlement and they'll file a civil case. But do they, much like the USOC, much like USA Gymnastics, much like Penn State, do you, much like the Catholic Church, do you address the fundamental issues that allowed someone in power to abuse victims who then, some of them had the strength to tell someone in a position of power that could have protected them, but instead protected the program and protected the success of the program over the people it should have been protecting? It's a real problem in our institutions. And I don't know if it's elsewhere. It's obviously in the terms of the Catholic Church. It spreads far and wide through Europe and South America as well as in the United States. But it just really disgusts me that over and over again, there are all these excuses as to why we've allowed this to happen. When the bottom line is you allow this to happen because you care more about the institution than you care about the people who make the institution.
You know what? I should know the answer to this. I know that Penn State suffered a decent number of penalties in terms of its athletic program.
Yeah, but you know what? Their football program is pretty on top again. It's not like they got, the death penalty
right.
like Baylor did years ago.
And you have to get rid of the program.
Uh-huh. And you look at like a school like Baylor, there's another school that had a crisis of sexual assaults on their football team. And Art Briles covering it up. And the NCAA, because now they're a somewhat successful sports program, they haven't faced really the type of punishment that they should face.
You know what's horrible about these? That there's so few criminal prosecutions. Well, we got to see the incredibly brave women in the Nasser thing, who, thanks to the judge, were able to do their
criminal prosecution
victim impacts.
That,
I know, but how rare is that? I mean, who's going to be prosecuted here? I don't know if statutes of limitations ran.
I mean,
or
I
whatever,
guess who do you?
Really
I mean,
troubling.
I guess who do you do? I mean, the man is dead. The guy who did it.
Well, because there are 50 athletic department staff members who knew about it. I assume some of them are alive. In any case, we're talking to Trini Kuznarek.
You know, I've been dying to talk to you about this transgender power lifter who won this tournament as a female and then was stripped of the awards. I'm not clear what to think about this because you don't want to be...
I'm with you.
Yeah.
This is the toughest... Right now, this is one of the biggest dilemmas, I think, for people who are a little bit more progressive. Like, I am all for... You know, be who you think you really are. This woman, so the quick story is, I know we're up against the clock. This woman is was a man, has been for the last year taking hormone therapy to become a woman.
Right.
And because she's been on hormone therapy for a year and has actually seen her strength decrease and said it's harder and whatnot for her to lift bigger amounts of weight, entered this, her driver's license says she is female, and so she registered in this powerlifting contest as a female. There was actually no one else in her age group, and she won all these trophies and set all these records. And then because she did that, they automatically tested her. She came back, I'm guessing, for higher levels of testosterone. Yep. They tested her again with someone in front of her, and she said, well, my genitalia is not going to match my gender. I'm transitioning. And they tested her again, and they stripped her of everything. Here's my issue, and this also happened with an Arjun handed me the Caster Semenya article from the runner from South Africa. Here's what I want to know, and none of these articles mention it. They do not mention what the testosterone levels of these women are when they test, because there is a significant difference. And I'm open-minded about it. I don't think you need a separate transgender category. I think that, you know, once you fully transition to female from male or from female to male, you should be able to compete at the gender that you want to. However, you better biologically be as close to that as possible, because I don't care what you say, there is a difference in male physiology and female physiology, and testosterone is huge. You talk to any physician, and they will tell you that testosterone is the why do you think people take steroids? There is a reason that female athletes use steroids. They use them to up their bone density, their muscle, their VO2 max. All of that is enhanced by testosterone. And so for me, if I don't know the numbers where they are,
well, you know,
do have a physical competitive advantage. And that is not fair to a woman who is trained just as hard as you, but is not physiologically or biologically as strong or as fast.
Can I make a suggestion? We should continue this next week.
I know. It's complicated.
Yeah,
it's really
and
complicated.
We're running out of time, but it's a great story. And it's a thorny one.
Did you guys
one.
Watch Game of Thrones quickly?
Yes.
Were you disappointed?
She watched the wrong episode.
I watched
what are you
the right episode
about? No,
last
you did.
Night.
Oh,
yes,
you
I did.
Did.
I saw the stabbing, which was in the middle. They should have ended it with this. It's too bad.
I know. They should have just ended it with the stabbing.
And the dragon, and that should have been it.
I know.
Don't you think?
I do.
They went
I
on
love
after
the
that.
Dragon.
Yeah, the dragon was very good. I didn't tell you
about that. I wanted to end on something light because we always talk about such heavy stuff.
Yeah, okay. Next time we'll talk about Game of Thrones. Everybody's complaining about it. Trini Kuznarek is an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston.
Congrats,
and she'll be competing in the Boston Marathon next spring. We're so proud of you, Trini. Coming up, Frontline's Michael Kirk joins us to talk about his latest documentary, Supreme Revenge. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, the failed Supreme Court nomination of Robert Bork changed everything. Democrats' attack on him enraged Republicans, and the verb to bork even made it into the dictionary, defined as to defame or vilify a person systematically. How this started a 30-year partisan grudge match and created a conservative court we have today and may have for decades is the subject for the latest Frontline documentary, Supreme Revenge. In a couple of minutes, Frontline's Michael Kurt joins us.
From there, we open the lines and ask you about grudges. We see what holding on to one has created in partisan politics. What about you? Do you grudgingly let go of them? Or, like Ahab, are you determined to ride your grudge out till the bitter end? Then CNN's John King joins us to go over the latest political headlines. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Houston Friday, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday. We're at the Boston Public Library. On Tuesdays, we are every Tuesday.
I don't know if you're going to survive this segment, but let's see, Marjorie. So Missouri is the latest state to sign strict anti-abortion legislation into law, joining Georgia, Mississippi, Ohio, and Alabama in what seems to be a push to get the Supreme Court to consider overturning Roe v. Wade. Now that the court is a conservative majority, anti-abortion activists might get what they want. How we got to this point is the subject of a new Frontline documentary. It's called Supreme Revenge, which looks at the war for control of the Supreme Court from Robert Bork to Brett Kavanaugh. You can catch it tonight at 10 o'clock on GBH2. We're joined by Michael Kirk. Michael is the producer and director of Frontline Supreme Revenge. Michael, congratulations yet again. It's good to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So a lot of us are well-versed in the crazy Kavanaugh hearings and Christine Blasey Ford and her accusations against him. But in this piece you do on Frontline, you trace this all back, this kind of craziness, to Ronald Reagan's appointment of Robert Bork back in, I think, 1981.
How did the process of nominating United States Supreme Court justices become so political? I watched the Kavanaugh hearings. I watched them that day, and I watched them on videotape. And that first day was so unbelievably intense that I said, we've got to find out, when did this start? It can't just have been because of Trump and the Trump administration. When we went back and looked at Reagan at the end of the conservative arc of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and Robert Bork, the most well-known, most feared by Democrats, a conservative commentator of the law in 1987, the final appointment of Ronald Reagan, finally going to have a conservative Supreme Court after Warren and Berger, and the way the Democrats reacted in that first salvo of creating a kind of super politically charged environment on national television set us all up for where we ended up last fall.
You know, I thought I remembered a lot of that battle, Michael, until I saw the documentary. And here's Frank Luntz. People obviously know him as a GOP pollster, talking about the unprecedented lengths the Democrats went to stop the confirmation of Judge Bork. Here he is.
So you're using every technique and every tool at your disposal. And we've never seen that before.
This is Gregory Peck. Please urge your senators to vote against the Bork nomination. Because if Robert Bork wins a seat on the Supreme Court, it will be for life, his life and yours.
It was the first moment that you saw all-out war over a Supreme Court nominee. It's the first example of the politics of destruction of the modern era.
Boy, Gregory Peck, talk about the voice of God.
I know.
Did that ever sound exactly like that?
I know, To Kill a Mockingbird,
I didn't remember
right
that at all.
But, you know, Ted Kennedy figured prominently gave that big speech saying that Bork was going to be wreak horror all over the land. Linda Greenhouse.
Bork's America.
Right. Linda Greenhouse, a longtime New York Times Supreme Court reporter, had a more nuanced view of him, which made me wonder, did Ted Kennedy go overboard? Was it indeed an unfair Borking, or was this all about conservative versus liberal, and it didn't matter how far to the right he was?
We talked to people on Kennedy's staff at the time, and one of them, Jeff Blattner, is in the film, and Blattner said that speech had been prepared well in advance of Bork's nomination by Reagan. They were ready just in case it was Bork. They feared that it would be Bork, and Kennedy himself had decided this was the time to stop what Democrats had been sort of really relaxed about what they were getting from the court, and it's not been a big issue among Democrats who's, you know, running for president and what will he do for the court. In this case, Kennedy realized, oh, my God, we're on our way. And all of the things that he stood for and believed in, you know, the privacy stuff, the Brown versus Board of Education, all of it was in jeopardy, he thought, if Bork won. So he decided to make a super example out of and fire the warning shot. They had created murder boards. They'd had Larry Tribe come in and help prepare the committee members to ask hard questions of Bork. They were ready to go in case it happened. And when it happened, within an hour, Ted Kennedy is on the floor of the Senate blowing the trumpet saying, here we go.
But when you say within an hour, it was within an hour, if I remember correctly from watching your film over the weekend, of Ed Meese, the attorney general for Ron Reagan, giving him a courtesy call, essentially. Right. So he is ready. And an hour after that call, he's on the floor. You know, when you mentioned Larry Tribe a minute ago, who we've had on the show, one of the things that is most stirring to me is how many things and people existed then who are still major players. Now, the most important one in your film is Mitch McConnell. We'll get to him in a minute. But I also was not aware, I'm embarrassed to say, that the Federalist Society, which, as most people know, put together the list of, I think it was 23 possible Supreme Court nominees.
10 in the beginning and then 10 more.
Okay, so 22, whatever it was for Donald Trump. And you say in your film, a lot of people think it was that list that got conservatives on board, that got the presidency for Donald Trump. This gave birth to the Federalist Society. Here's that same Linda Greenhouse talking about the Federalist Society, what started as a student networking group, becoming this juggernaut of propelling conservative judges. Here's Greenhouse from the New York Times.
The forces for Bork, who suffered that very painful defeat, didn't give up, didn't go home to sulk. They went underground and built an infrastructure to create a new reality for our judicial politics.
And if I remember correctly, do you not say that Scalia, as a professor, Scalia, Bork, I mean, they had these advisors, people who became giants,
exactly.
Obviously. Yeah.
There were three campus chapters, one at Yale, one at Harvard, and one at Chicago, University of Chicago. Scalia was a professor at University of Chicago Law School, so he was the advisor to the Chicago chapter. Bork was at Yale. He was the advisor to the Yale chapter. And I don't remember who it was at Harvard. But those two future kind of exemplars of a certain way of thinking that was different and engendered a bit by the Reagan presidency, those two men, who also parenthetically worked at the Justice Department on raising up judges for the Gerald Ford administration. And guess who worked for them at the Justice Department? Mitch McConnell, young Mitch McConnell. So that triangle was formed back in those days.
And Mitch McConnell, was he a freshman during the Bork thing?
He is a first-term senator, United States senator, out of Kentucky. As he watches this, coming in on the coattails of Reagan, as he watches this happen, and something he's been working on since he was an intern on Capitol Hill rises up inside of him, and that's when he joins the fight.
Well, you know, you've got to give conservative Republicans a lot of credit here because they, as Linda Greenhouse just said, they didn't go home and sulk. They decided to fight back, and their success is being seen right now. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but they understood, in a way Democrats haven't, the importance of the Supreme Court and the importance of federal judges.
It's such an interesting question, Marjorie, because or point, because I ask, of course, lots of Democrats that I interviewed, including very powerful ones right now, where were the Democrats when the Federalist Society was growing? And they said, we didn't need a Federalist Society. Every law school in America was super liberal. It was a training ground for liberals, which is what the genesis of the Federalist Society was anyway. Because when you talk to people like Jack Goldsmith, a wonderful, conservative, intelligent Harvard faculty member, a famous and historic figure during the George W. Bush period, Jack says when he was at Yale, it was almost impossible to find a kind of affinity group of other conservatives who felt the same way you did. And that's the need in the beginning. at the Federalist Society, and the big funders of the Federalist Society, Olin Foundation and others, that's the need they met.
What'd you say their budget is now after?
Well, they started out at $700,000.
What is it now?
It's $26 million.
So they've grown a little bit.
60,000 members, yeah. Chapters everywhere, and 5 United States Supreme Court justices.
We're talking to Michael Kirk, who is the man behind the new Frontline documentary, Supreme Revenge. You can see it tonight. So let's move forward to Clarence Thomas. And, you know, it's amazing. It's almost embarrassing how much I'd forgotten. I thought I remembered every minute of that like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
What I failed to remember is, one, how polite and charming the relationship between the chair of that committee, one Joe Biden, was with Clarence Thomas, making jokes about their age, as you have in the thing, and saying pre-Anita Hill coming on the scene, this is not about character or some such statement. And what I had also forgotten, which really is embarrassing, is the great NPR Nina Totenberg. She is the one who essentially uncovered the Anita Hill story. Correct, Michael?
Kicked tires and broke the story.
That's the way she said it.
Right.
Yeah,
I went out on that kick sometimes. She heard Biden say, this is kind of out of the blue, this is not about character, this is not, you see the moment in the film and you think, man, he has changed from this sort of super avuncular character, he and Kennedy side by side, both of them unable to, or felt they were unable for different reasons to attack an African-American conservative justice sitting there in the chair.
Well, Kennedy was not just African-American. Kennedy was because he had his own problems.
He had his own
white African-American, whoever the nominee was.
Totally.
Okay.
That Palm Beach had just happened.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It had just happened.
He was down there in his underpants waking up.
We'll leave that description to you.
Well, we just did, didn't we?
To go to bars.
Okay. And so Totenberg reads into this.
So she says that and says, hey, wait a minute. Nobody said the word character. Nobody raised anything. What is this non sequitur all about? And she goes out and kicks some tires. It doesn't take any time at all for her to discover that a professor at the University of Oklahoma, or in Oklahoma, I think the Oral Roberts University law professor, Anita Hill, is making allegations about the head of the, of all things, the Equal Opportunity Commission, about sexual harassment of her. And Nina breaks that story, and in a wonderful moment inside the film, I ask Nina, what was it like? She said, I walked up on the hill on Monday morning after this had aired on the radio on the weekend, and she said, it was, and she does a much better impression of its explosion than I will, but it was intense.
Absolutely.
How Washington changed at that moment.
And then you had, I think, in Anita Hill, almost the perfect victim, or maybe the perfect victim. I don't want to call her a victim. I mean, she's obviously survived and gone on to have a great life.
Right.
But you always talk about that in these cases of he said, she said, in the beautiful teal suit, so well spoken, with her mother and father there and the whole thing. And obviously, it did not matter. And you had a band of white older men, senators, going toe-to-toe.
The one word we haven't said in this conversation is that after the Bork nomination deteriorates, catches on fire, and goes away, a new word is added to the American dictionary,
borked.
Right? Yeah. So borked means, you know, you are attacked, you're assaulted from all sides, and you're taken down. And if you look in the dictionary, that's sort of it. Well, what they were worried, what the Republicans sitting on that up on the table, they're looking out at Anita Hill. What they were worried about, more than anything, was that Clarence Thomas was not going to be borked. So he'd never answered a question fully. He talked about it, hypotheticals, and in this particular moment, they know they have to counterattack to save him, or he's going to go down, and they do.
So we all talked ad nauseum about the nomination of Merrick Garland by Barack Obama, and immediately Mitch McConnell saying, not happening, no interview, no hearing, no nothing. Is it too much of a stretch? Because I think you do make this connection that Merrick Garland, the reaction to Garland, is essentially a multiple decade delayed response to the borking of that judge. Yes.
The one thing you know about Mitch McConnell when you talk to people who know him really well is he's like a three level chess player, works way out in the future. When he was that first term senator and that thing happened to Bork, he takes to the floor of the Senate, and basically wags his finger at the Democrats, Kennedy and others, and says, you're going to rue the day that you politicized this moment and took this guy down for his ideology. because someday you're going to want something, and I'm going to deny it, and my colleagues are going to deny it, and it just is. Everything has changed from this moment on. And when he did that to Merrick Garland, that is within hours of the death of Anton Scalia, he said rather than give Obama, who had 10 months to go in his presidency, the same amount of time essentially that Reagan had when he named Bork, he said, no, not in the, you're not going out the door and leave us with a Democrat on the court in a swing seat.
So tell us after this, well, tell us a little bit more about McConnell, because in some of these stories that we've read to go along with your being here today, it talks about how basically all he's done is approve judges, calls himself the Grim Reaper,
right.
Says, you know, he doesn't really worry about the legislation the middle class might worry about, you know, health care, those kinds of things, nothing to do with guns, nothing to do with what the House may pass, now their Democratic House, to get to him. So that's all he's doing is not all, but it seems like almost all he's doing is appointing judges. They're appointing them like left and right.
If you ask him or anybody who knows him, what's it all about with you? What policy are you in favor of? They all say the same thing. He's not a policy guy. He's a politics guy. He's not a guy who cares about policy in that sense, and this case absolutely manifests it. He does care about conservative Republicans and Republicans being judges. As they say, he says, you know, you can get legislation passed, but two years from now, a new Congress could come in, a new president could come in, and away it goes. But if I get a judge in the appeals court level, even at the district judge, federal judge level, or if I get certainly a Supreme Court, that's a lifetime.
And
six presidencies.
And this has basically assured his power, because I don't think he's going to have to worry about somebody to the right running against him in Kentucky this time around, because he's made this play with these judges.
Well, if he does nothing else in the rest of his career and is beaten by the new challenger that's facing him, and it's possible, I suppose, if he does nothing else, he has left us for the first time since Bork, since 30 years, since Reagan, with a staunchly conservative, you might say ultra-conservative, United States Supreme Court, approved not only by Mitch McConnell in some ways, but certainly by the Federalist Society.
We're talking to Michael Kirk, and by the way, it's not ridiculous to assume that even if Donald Trump is not reelected, he could have one, two more nominations during his time in McConnell's with the two oldest justices on the court,
you
both
mean if
liberals,
if
Bader Ginsburg and Breyer. No, even in
if
the next,
Republicans control the Senate.
No, even in the next year. I mean,
oh, yeah, the next
year. Two very old, and one has been ill from time to time.
But I think a lot of people that don't like conservative judges fear that even if a Democratic president wins in 2020 and the Senate the Republicans hold on in the Senate.
So many people I talked to, you guys, said it's not about the presidency. This is what Democrats need to learn. It's not about the presidency if you have a Republican Senate. It's got to be about the Senate if you have a Republican president. Because what will happen then is Trump will not be able, unless he gets really to the moderate side, he's not going to be able to get a Supreme Court justice approved, advising consent by the United States Senate. And when I talked to Professor Tribe, he said it's not outside the realm of possibility that in that circumstance, Republican president, Democratic Senate, or Republican Senate, Democratic president, that the court itself will begin to shrink as we become more and more and more politicized. That's the long-term effect of this, that you could find yourself with five people on the United States Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, today, forget the six and seven, we have five, thanks to the elevation of Brett Kavanaugh. And I have to say, you know, let's start with Jane Mayer, because she captured Jane Mayer of dark money fame and everything else, obviously, at The New Yorker. By the time Kavanaugh was nominated in 2018, obviously Democrats were ready for a fight. And Mayer talks about Christine Blasey Ford's testimony.
It was like watching Clarence Thomas all over again. This was another version of the high-tech lynching. It has become this completely politicized drama. He took the allegations away from Christine Blasey Ford and turned it into a huge fight between Democrats and Republicans. He's trying to rally all the Republicans to his side.
You know, the parallels to Thomas, I mean, you mentioned how the perfect survivor, the perfect witness was right. Anita Hill. She couldn't be any more perfect than Christine Blasey Ford. When she says, and I remember it, and then you play it in your film. I'm terrified here. It was so real and so genuine. And high-tech lynching and Kavanaugh blaming the Clintons, blaming the whatever. When he comes back on day two or day whatever it is, and right. It's clear he's talking to one person, namely the president of the United States. Were the parallels as striking to you as you're making this thing, Michael?
Astonishingly so. With all the nuance added because of what is happening now and who the president is now and what the circumstances are now and the way that committee is divided up, the Republicans, many of whom were there for Ford, for Thomas, and many of whom were there for Bork. They're still there, the older white men who represent the Republican Party on that committee and in the Senate. On the other side, there were on the Democratic side, there were many women up there, sitting up there, three women sitting there among those people. The battle that we saw take place on our television screens since Thomas and Hill is played out again at a much more kind of intense, and it feels like a fundamental way that we're now down to, if Thomas was claiming race and Bork was claiming, hey, you've invaded my, you know, you're after me for my ideology. Kavanaugh said, you are after me because of my politics. And he declared his politics, something none of us, I grew up believing as a young boy in Idaho that the Supreme Court was a nice, safe, neutral, philosopher king environment, right? And that, the thing people fear, is what Kavanaugh took away in that moment.
You know, Michael Kirk, Margie and I have debated on the air, and many journalists and real people in the world debate, does the venom of this era survive Donald Trump, whether he's gone in 2020 or 24? That's a moot question. But what's not a moot question for me is, does the venom of the Supreme Court confirmation process survive Trump? And I have to say, from watching your film, my conclusion is it absolutely does. Just like Mitch McConnell's memory is endless. I mean, right. You talk about holding a grudge for decades. The Democrats still, I assume, harbor incredible bad feeling about the Garland situation.
Right.
So there's no reason to think, as Senate's and White House Oval Office change hands over the next handful of years, the venom directed by one party is going to be replaced by the venom of another with no end in sight.
This is really what has changed from Ted Kennedy saying Robert Bork's American, kind of being hyperbolic about it, all the way down to where we are now with that. Yes, there's plenty of blame for the Democrats in this, and there's lots of blame for the Republicans in this. And where we are is that place where everybody is, including all of us, apparently, where they're just at each other around this, the sort of final place where you would think getting to yes would be easier to do. Now, there are things to watch closely. Is Roberts going to the center? Is he dragging Kagan and Kavanaugh with him? Is that a possibility in the near future? We don't know enough about that yet. We all know that the court and its composition and its attitudes change now and then over time, and maybe that will happen. But I watch the abortion issue now rising up again and go back to the history of the electoral political implications of abortion as an issue. Go back 30 years there and watch this march almost in tandem with what's been going on in the courts. And you say to yourself, not now, maybe a year from now, 3 years from now, whenever that issue is going to come up again, and who is on that court and who has put them on that court. And one other just final thought.
Sure.
82 or 86 cases a year are decided by the United States Supreme Court. But out at the appeals court level and at the district levels, 6,000, 8,000 a year out there, and there's a whole new cast of judges out there who are not there for one or two terms or Donald Trump's presidency, even if it's six more years. They are there for a long, long time.
Right, and the appeals court is where, if it doesn't make the Supreme Court, the decision is final, right?
Yeah.
If it doesn't, so, and that's what he has been very successful at doing, McConnell, is getting these judges on the district and appeals court. So I guess we're taking a hard turn right here, no matter what happens, Jim.
So, Michael, on your way out of the studio, if you pass an EMT who is free to help Marjorie, can you send him or her in
I can
briefly?
See that she needs oxygen.
I think she needs some.
And maybe an espresso. I don't know.
Congratulations.
Spectacular,
it was
as always.
It was really good. And for people who come from a certain perspective about freedom and civil rights. It was a very disturbing film. Michael Kirk is a producer and director of the new Frontline documentary, Supreme Revenge. You can catch it tonight at 10 o'clock on WGBH. You can keep up on everything Frontline does online at pbs.org/frontline. Michael, very good to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in. Coming up, we're talking public safety, public schools, and more with Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marg Regan. We are broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. City Council President Andrea Campbell is on her way. She's texted us. She'll be here in a couple of minutes. Do you think she's stuck in traffic?
I think there is a 70-30 chance that she is indeed stuck in traffic. Maybe she needs to get one of those little scooters to
you
get
know,
around the
I
city.
I was checking my email. We started today's show, if you just tuned in, talking off Beth Tytel's column in the Globe about how everybody needs to add a cushion, as she calls it, to their arrival time for virtually anything they do. Doctor's appointments, getting your kid to school. As you tried to get your kid to the train or the bus yesterday?
Train
yesterday. And he had to run the final, what is
get out
X
of the car
number of blocks?
With his bags. Luckily, he was young and in shape, and he was able to run to the train station.
So this has become...
And he beat me there by like 15 minutes.
It turns out this has become our, we didn't even know it, our monthly road rage section. But we should ask, even if Andrea Campbell is not held up by traffic, the interesting thing is, you know, what's the city, what are they doing and what can they do? What kind of pressure are they exerting? I don't know if you saw my show last night. You should have. Marty Walsh was on.
Of course I saw your
on,
show last night, Jim.
And I asked
always watch it.
You know, obviously he's very good friends with the governor, and he traveled to Washington with the governor for Infrastructure Week, a bipartisan thing, which I sort of love, actually. I don't know how much it achieved, but I like the concept. And I asked him which side he was on, that being Mayor Walsh, in that I had the two Transportation Committee chairs, Strauss on the House side and the Senate chair there as well, who said that they believed that transportation in Massachusetts needed new taxes. And that's in part because the guy from Mattapoisett took 2.5 hours to get to work, and the guy from Winthrop, 6 miles away, took 55 minutes to get to work. And the governor said, we don't need new revenue, at least for now. And Marty Walsh unequivocally, not hostily towards the governor, said new money is needed. And that's going to be a huge debate on Beacon Hill. And if the governor, and we'll ask him on Thursday when he's here at 1 o'clock, is his position unchangeable? Meaning if the legislature passes some sort of transportation infrastructure bill that has a new funding source, otherwise known as taxes, connected to it, will he veto it? Because my guess is there'll not be 2/3 votes in the House and the Senate, maybe in the Senate, but I would doubt in the House, to override a gubernatorial veto on taxes, which puts Governor Baker in a really tight position on an issue that I think matters to virtually everybody in the Commonwealth.
Well, you know, the president is rightly talking about this great economy, best economy we've ever had, lowest unemployment in 50 or 60 years, whatever it is. And no matter how much credit you want to give the guy, I mean, he's entitled to boast about it because it is a great economy. It does seem like it would be a good time maybe to put a little money in some of these longstanding problems like the falling apart bridges and roads. You know, they talked about infrastructure. He did with Pelosi and with Schumer last week, and they agreed on something, and the president was going to talk about what exactly his proposal is. So maybe they are going to do something. I mean, heaven knows.
Yeah, but you know what I worry about there? I hope so, too, and everybody came out of that meeting positive. If the reason Nancy Pelosi, we'll talk to John King about this a little later, she's getting a lot of pressure from her own members about impeachment hearings. If the reason she doesn't want to start something as important as whether or not to impeach a president is for political reasons, I think it's fair to say it's 100% political reasons, because she said he is self-impeachable, that he's already committed. If that can't be done for political reasons, then I would argue that Nancy Pelosi would argue we can't do infrastructure for political reasons, because if Donald Trump has a signing ceremony for a $2 trillion bill to fix our roads and bridges, he's going to get a huge amount of credit, as he should. So if she won't do one, why will she do the other?
Because I think that would really be, I mean, to say you're not going to sign an infrastructure bill because he could get the credit when we desperately need an infrastructure bill.
Why is she saying about impeachment?
Because I think that's a different
situation. How's it different?
Well, I think her argument is, and you can buy it or not buy it, that isn't directly hurting the American people. I think when you need infrastructure drastically and you're not going to do it, not to mention the jobs it would create, that is a step too
Wait
far,
a second.
If you ask me.
Nancy Pelosi believes that this president has obstructed justice, which
right.
is a crime. I would argue if she is right, that hurts the American
people. Well, you could say it hurts the separation of powers in the United States of America. It hurts the country constitutionally. It hurts us in going forward and where other presidents could go if they're going to be...
I'd say it's a problem.
Yeah, but I don't think that's... I mean, maybe I'm crazy.
I don't think that's
front and center to people.
You don't think when Schumer and Pelosi are having private discussions, they are not saying... that we have worry about what the political impact would be of an infrastructure bill for $2 trillion? With all due respect, you're nuts.
Well, I think you're nuts.
That would be the biggest. You don't think that would be 1,000 times more important than his phony middle-class tax break.
The economy is going through the roof. There are lots of people who say he deserves credit for it. And I know that. And that's what lots of people are saying. Not for everybody. And he doesn't deserve the credit's continuation of Obama.
So let me be
clear. I think that people can differentiate between what they like about this guy and whether he can get to do certain things. But we don't have to debate it anymore, Jim. And your ridiculous opinion, we don't have to discuss this anymore. You know why?
Why?
Because Andrea Campbell has shown up.
Now, we are hoping, we've been discussing transportation all day,
wasn't
city
traffic.
Council president. It wasn't?
It was not. Oh,
we're
no.
We're very sorry to hear that.
Oh, no.
It was
we're very upset.
No,
where the hell were you then?
A budget hearing with the fire department.
A budget hearing with the fire department. Okay.
And, you know, I had to ask my questions. Diversity.
Okay.
It's good to see you, city council president.
We have a lot of work to do.
She joins us every month. She is the president of Boston City Council, Andrea Campbell. Good to see you.
Well, as long as you mentioned that, there is a really unbelievable figure. I think 15 women in the fire department.
16.
1,500?
Yes, 1%.
Yeah, that's... not where we should be.
Well,
I guess.
It's 1% there. It's 13% on the police department. What's your what's being done about?
Not
this?
Enough. Yeah, you know, one thing I love about coming on here, I can be very frank and
yes,
honest.
Yes, you can. We love that.
As opposed to at budget hearings where you can't.
Well, no,
of course,
I'm always there too, and I was frankly applauding the commissioner and the department for what they're doing, but. You know, we put out a report in January with 10 specific things the department could do. One was just releasing the data, making it transparent. We haven't even done that. You know, it's really disappointing. And then talking about what we can do in terms of the solutions, right? So the cadet program is one example, asked a question about that. That's not really moving. Other things we could be doing is studying the civil service, the impact it's having. The commissioner talked about in 2014, we had almost 50 women sort of apply. And then I think a couple of years later, we had maybe it was a little under 45 women. And then last year, you know, maybe it was 40 women. Only if, you know, none of them really made it through the process because of civil service. So, like, these are the elephants in the room we need to be talking about and grappling with. And we're just not doing that.
You know, you mentioned that, if I may just sort of say, you mentioned the cadet program. You say it's not achieving its goal. Mayor Walsh was with me last night, and I broached both these things, the 13% number of cops who are women. And by the way, in some command positions, the numbers are worse. And only 1% of firefighters being women. Here's what the mayor had to say in response.
We're addressing them with the police department. We have the cadet program, and I think 50% of all of, or mostly all of our cadets that were put on in the last 3 years are women. Those folks will go on to the police department eventually. And the fire department, we're working, trying to create opportunities, trying to create a cadet program, get a vote to the council, up to the legislature, but also go out and recruit veterans, women, veterans, and veterans of color to take the police and fire test. That's another way of getting on.
You know, just starting with the cadet thing, if he's right that 50% of the cadets in the last 3 years have been women, that's a pretty major step, isn't it?
So we have a cadet program for the police department, but what we're finding out is we could be recruiting a lot more women through that cadet program, and we are not. And right now, if you look at the cadet classes and you pull apart the demographics, we could have a lot more women, a lot more people of color
into those classes so that we could then have a police department that's more diverse in terms of people of color and women. We can be doing better. The fire department, we are sitting with legislation at the council, waiting for the administration to demand a hearing so we can have a hearing on this home rule petition that then has to go up to the state house. So my question to the
Which would create a cadet program for firefighters. Okay.
So my question at the budget hearing before I ran over here was, you know, where's the administration with respect to scheduling that hearing? The commissioner says, you know, I'm waiting to hear. And then the second thing is, well, what's the appetite at the state house? He doesn't know. And I said, how do we not sort of know that, right? And it's not on the commissioner, right? This is the leadership of the administration in making sure that this happens. But I think something simple, this is why I think this is really what troubles me, is the number one issue for me is transparency around these issues. So to get the data that actually demonstrates that our police, fire, and EMS are not reflective of the demographics of the city of Boston, I had to go through, you know, you have to go through hurdles. I'm in the system. It shouldn't take so long. This should be on our dashboards when you walk into City Hall, where you can see the numbers, and maybe it's not what we expect, but at least you can see it. We're transparent about the problem. And then we can all get on the same page in terms of what we do to change it. And I'm not seeing that. And that was one recommendation in the report. And then the second is, of course, creating this cadet program, but going all in to create it for the fire department. Another is addressing civil service, and this is not, you know, veterans against women and veterans against people of color. Even if we recruited all of the veterans that were women and people of color, it would not be enough to make these departments align with the demographics of the city of Boston. So we just have a lot more work to do, and it's not enough to say we're doing the cadet program, we have to do recruitment in military spaces. That will never get us to parity in these departments with respect to women and people of color, given the demographics in this city. And that's where we need to be bold and courageous.
Well, it also seems that there's a recurring theme here, whether we're talking about this or the schools. It's a lack of urgency. I mean, it's kind of like we can wait another 6 months, or we'll do it next year or after the budget. You know what I mean? And then it drags on and drags on.
And I think, you know, maybe I'm a little frustrated because, you know, this morning I'm having a conversation with some folks in the community around public safety and what we can do. And these folks have good ideas and suggestions. Where they get frustrated is how slow we are in government to respond and to act upon these really great suggestions. So for the public safety or lack of diversity in our public safety agencies, you have the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, you have MAMLEO, you have organizations that have been fighting for a really long time for the city to do some very reasonable things to change these numbers. And they're waiting on us. And so I think where I get frustrated is why does it take so long? And in my report that I put out in January, I've been asking all of the public safety agencies, what's the response? And I'll give you another example, easy stuff. We have a diversity officer at the police department, a diversity officer at the fire department. They have no budget, no staff. If we are serious about them doing adequate recruitment and doing something about the promotions within the departments, they need a staff, they need a budget. That hasn't changed in this proposed budget, which is really devastating and disappointing at the same time.
Can I get back to one specific proposal rather than discussing a whole universe of them? Civil service is a more complicated issue, I would argue. But the cadet program, I think you said a minute ago that you were talking to administration people about what's the temperature on Beacon Hill on this. What public reason could anyone ever be opposed to creating a cadet program if it'll bring more women and people of color into the fire department?
Well, I learned this firsthand because when I proposed the idea with Councilor Linehan, who was still on the council at the time, yeah. This was before the mayor agreed to do it. At the time, the mayor hadn't committed. Uh-huh. So we just committed to doing a hearing just to have the conversation. I had some of the veterans groups, you know, Fox 25 and some of the media outlets saying, how dare you propose this idea? It goes around civil service and it goes against veterans. So it was this attempt to pit veterans against women or people of color. And I said, no, that's not what we're doing here. We have an existing cadet program for the police department. And they have seen tremendous success. Our current commissioner, who is the first African-American to serve as the commissioner, he started off as a cadet. And so we said, why wouldn't we do something similar that we know works for the fire department? Since then, though, I have been engaging with veterans, including one spokesperson who headed up some of those veteran organizations, come to find out lives in my district. We have grown so deep in our relationship because he says, I see what you're trying to do here. He even recently wrote an editorial to The Globe to say, I was on the opposite side of this issue when I initially met Councilor Campbell. Not anymore, because I see she's trying to do something to change those numbers for women and people of color, and it's not easy. And she's trying to make a process that currently helps veterans. Great, give veterans what they deserve, but a process that is fair for everyone. And right now, to get onto the fire department in the city of Boston, you have to be a disabled vet. Not even just, I'll put this in quotes, a regular vet. A disabled vet if you want a real chance on joining our department. And I just don't think that should be the only pathway for someone to have this career.
We're talking Andrea Campbell, president of the Boston City Council.
Years ago, and maybe it's changed, I hope it's changed, I had the sense, being a reporter at the Boston Herald, that there were people who didn't want women or people of color on the Boston Fire Department. I mean, we don't have a great record of people of color on any of these departments until very recently. And look at the state police.
Oh, the state police needs work, too.
I think there's some racism and sexism.
Well, that's why I asked before, what's the public argument on Beacon Hill? Yeah. I understand what might be behind the scenes, but if you're called upon in a hearing on Beacon Hill to say, why do you have a question about creating a modest-sized program that's going to diversify a police and fire department, well, a fire department in this case, so that it better reflects what the community it serves looks like, the only public argument I assume you could hear is the veterans' argument, but yeah. I think that you have that person on your side is a big deal. We're talking to Andrea Campbell.
So let's talk a little bit about violence protection. I know that the police department in Dorchester and South Boston is doing this training with body cameras, but you raise a great point. And obviously, in springtime going into summer, Commissioner Gross and all the cops are very worried about increase in violence in the summertime. That we do spend millions of dollars in these grants from the state to violence prevention and intervention programs. But how do we know if they work? And I sometimes wonder whether if the schools were better and the job situation were better, then we wouldn't need these so many violence protection programs, because if you were doing well in school and had a job, you probably wouldn't be misbehaving.
Right. I mean, prevention is key. I just held a community meeting. It's a consistent space I create in my district. We call it Constructing Peaceful Communities. We held one on Friday. We have four breakout sessions. One is for intervention. Another is prevention, reentry, and enforcement. We had community members there, police, Chief Hooley from EMS. I mean, you name it, every stakeholder was in this space, and we were brainstorming ideas. What can we do? So yes, schools and making sure that our young people have access to an excellent education is important. I know that firsthand. Wouldn't be here but for a great education. And we're not delivering that for every child in the city of Boston. Jobs. People need good jobs, and not just jobs where they show up and get sort of the minimum pay. A career, a trajectory that puts them on a pathway for a career, good benefits, a good pension, good retirement plan for their families. They also need a sense of community. They need folks in the neighborhood to know each other. They need good parks. The list is long. But for those areas that we have under-resourced and underserved for a long time, and those usually include neighborhoods like Dorchester, Mattapan, we got to do a little bit more. And so there is funding that is available for violence prevention and intervention. Some of this funding is through the city, some of it is through the state. In my first year on the council, I chair the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice. My very first hearing was reviewing some of the state budgets, grants. And one is called the Shannon Grant, another is an SSYI grant. And this is millions. And this started under Governor Patrick, who I used to work with as a lawyer. And I remember SSYI, and I said, okay, give me the history on this. We've been getting it for 10 years. Who gets the money? How many young people are we touching? We get it for 10 years, and the list of organizations was the same 10 or 11 organizations that had been receiving the money over the course of those 10 years. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. We also charged them different rates. So some organizations that serve more of our young people, because the young people said this organization's really great, the rate was, say, $500. Another organization where they only serve one or two young people, they just weren't, the young people weren't picking that program, the rate was almost $1,400. And I thought, wait a minute, we've since done a little bit to change that. But then I said, okay, pull this apart. Outside of the organizations we touch, how many young people are being touched by this $1.2 million? And I think it was under 60. And I said, excuse me? And I remember being at a hearing, it was a 4-hour hearing, and I said, what do you mean? What? And so we have had a lot of subsequent conversations since to really look at where this money is going and if it's having the intended outcome that we want. Do we have metrics that we've defined? Do we have data that we collect? And the answer to many of these questions is no. So I called for a public hearing to say, we need to bring this conversation out into a public space. We need to bring in our grantees that are getting the money, some experts, taxpayers, right? You know, this is about transparency and accountability, and we have to do better. And so my colleagues on the council have signed on. Some folks in the administration are working a part, you know, looking to be a part of this conversation too. But I just know that we can do better to ensure those dollars, which are not too many dollars when you think about our overall city budget is $3.5 billion, but those millions, we really need to figure out, are they having the impact in helping reduce incidents of violence in certain communities? And right now, there are some organizations that may not actually be having that impact, but how do they know if we've never defined what that impact should look like?
You know, a couple of months ago, or maybe a month ago when you were here, Marjorie was asking questions about an op-ed you wrote about the schools in Boston that made her happy, because I think you and she share a fairly similar worldview and a sense of urgency. There's a new superintendent since we saw you last. What's your, I know it's early, but she's done a lot of outreach. She's done a lot of meetings. What's your initial impression? We haven't met her yet.
So, well, Brenda, I think she's great. She's making her rounds. Let me tell you, she has a tough job ahead of her, but I'm excited that she's accepted this tremendous role and responsibility. She did come to the council. Councilor Sabi George and the mayor hosted like a coffee meeting where we could just say hello. And what I told her in that meeting is, you know, Brenda, I look forward to working in partnership with you. I represent a district where the inequities that we see on paper, those are in my district for the most part. You can see it, you can feel it, the inequities are alive and well. You put students first, I will be standing with you. You take risk, I will be standing with you. You exercise courage, I will be standing with you. When you make mistakes after taking those risks, I will be standing with you. Because we need someone who is going to take risks. We need someone who is going to be courageous, who's going to be bold. And so I'm excited for her to take on this responsibility, to support her, to work in partnership. And like I said in that op-ed that I wrote, we have to make sure we don't micromanage her from City Hall, from the council, wherever. Allow her the sense of freedom to truly roll her sleeves up with her team and, of course, with the entire team at the bowling building and all the partners that work with us, our teachers, our staff, our students, our families, to get to work. So I'm excited for this.
You know, we're talking to Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell. I wasn't going to ask you this, but it just occurred when we talk about the schools. Paul Revel comes on. He used to be the Secretary of Education. We talked with him about this the other day. I heard this idea that I'd never heard before, and you're a Boston public school graduate, about Grove Hall. Did you read that story in the paper? And basically what it was is having a neighborhood, like, surround its students. And the kids – and Grove Hall is a tough neighborhood in Boston.
The Grove Hall Alliance.
Yes. Yeah. So
I've been a part of these conversations for over 2 years.
Well, you know better than I do. Yeah. Tell people what this is and what you think about it.
So the Grove Hall Alliance is – it's an idea. It is an idea that came out of some meetings that six principals – it used to be six schools. Now it's five because the Dearborn has moved out of Grove Hall – but principals that were collaborating amongst each other and now said, okay, how do we formalize this? How do we get recognized by the district and really make this a network of some sort? And so I started joining these conversations to say, how could I help you do that? And what's the idea with the Grove Hall Alliance? To create a pathway from K-0 to the 12th grade, because the schools range from K-0 to the 12th grade, in the Grove Hall section of Dorchester, that can meet the needs of the parents in that community. Right now, only 20% or so of the students that live in the Grove Hall area actually attend the schools in Grove Hall. They're bused and go everywhere else. And they said, we want to change that. We want to rebrand these schools. That, mind you, this is five principals of color, five women. We want to rebrand our schools. There are some great things happening in the Burke High School, the MLK Middle School, the Frederick School, the Trotter, the Haynes. Great things happening. We need more resources, and we think we get those resources when we work together versus in silos. There are some schools, for example, that have partnerships. Other schools in the same neighborhood do not have those same partnerships. They also want to create partnerships with higher ed institutions. In addition, there are some schools in the network that are innovation school. One is a pilot school, so they have some flexibilities that the school around the corner does not. So they're saying, how do we create this pathway of K-0 to 12th grade, rebrand ourselves for the families in our community, have a sense of power that this district and the bowling building sort of give them at their school level to test out new ideas, to be a little innovative, maybe make some mistakes along the way, but to truly have an impact. This is an idea that I think is one of many that could move the district in the right direction. And right now I've been talking to the superintendent, the interim superintendent, and others to say, 2 years is too long. We need to move. What are we going to do here? And I was excited to hear that the mayor had mentioned it in his meeting with the Globe.
Yeah.
And that's why people called me to say, let's move on this. And,
yeah.
and it shouldn't take 2 years, but right now I'm saying, okay, let's bring all the stakeholders together, including Jessica Tang. We were just emailing
President
from the
Boston Teachers Union
to say all of us could come together to create that pathway right in a community of Dorchester, which is predominantly a community of color. One of the poorest sections of the city of Boston is in Grove Hall. Make a difference for those families right in the community in which they live. That is a possibility, but the only way we make it happen is if we sort of challenge the status quo a little bit and try something new.
You know, and by the way, it's not just, it seems to me, I know very little about it except what I read, and Marjorie and I talked about it briefly, as Marjorie said, with Paul Revel. The concept should be applied everywhere, not just in underperforming districts, not just in districts with lower income people. The whole collaborative notion makes total sense.
Well,
to
it's
me.
Hard in Boston because you get into a fight about who's, you know, which neighborhoods are underserved and who's going to get bused where. But
it kind of happens now in different in ways. I mean, there are schools in Rosendale that come together. I mean, East Boston, these conversations are happening. Students in Eastie want to stay in Eastie. Mm-hmm. I was just at the Dever School this morning. And they are looking and talking to the McCormick, to UMass, to talk about how do we create not just a K through 12 system, a pre-K through 16 system with UMass right there. So a lot of it is rebranding and changing the narrative of some of these schools that are doing great things. Pulling families in, we have to do a better job of making them a part of this.
Well, if you're next door, it makes it a lot easier.
So this is what I hope Brenda takes on in her new role, along with some other ideas that she may have as well.
So before you leave, when you go, we're going to
Why do I have to go?
Well, because you came late and we're going to punish you. So City Council President Campbell, we're going to discuss grudges. And there's an article in the New York Times that says, well, the headline is, let go of your grudges, they're doing you no good. I think grudges are what keep me alive and going, actually. Are you a grudge-holding kind of person? Tell the truth.
It depends. I think I'm more mindful now of just sort of letting things go, not holding on to things. I think I need to let some more of it go with respect to the work. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There are some folks now that I engage with in the community around some of this public safety work where initially we didn't start off in a good way. And I had to take a step back to realize that some of the folks or some of the residents I'm engaging with have had some really traumatic things happen to them. They're doing their own work of healing. And I can't hold on to that, right? It's not personal if they're expressing their frustration to me in person or via email. It really is about a system, not me. It took me a little while to get there. I'm in my fourth year on the council. I think I've gotten there. But for a while, you hold on to that. You know, you get someone at the grocery store yelling at you, and it's like, don't yell at me. We're in this together, and I share your frustration. So I'm doing better, and my husband helps me with that.
Well, it's very mentally healthy, I
should say. That is very mentally
healthy. I think so.
I think that's why I only lasted 2 years in public service, actually, because I couldn't quite achieve that Zen level that Andrea Campbell has.
After he got elected, then he realized he was going to have to serve. That's
not they so didn't easy. Tell me that. They didn't tell me that.
Andrea
Campbell, it's great to see you as always.
Thank you.
Thanks
I
so
just
much.
Have to do one quick thing.
What? Sure.
My friend Alex Gray, who I used to work with in Governor Patrick's office, his mom apparently listens to us. So I just wanted to say hello to Ms. Gray.
Oh, hello.
Sure, she does a shout out every month. It's
okay.
Ms. Gray,
she
thank you for
show.
Listening. Why don't you tell her to come down next time you're here?
I will do that.
Tell
fabulous.
Her we do that.
Thank
we
you
hope
guys.
To meet
very
you.
Much.
Thank you very much. That was the voice of Andrea Campbell. She's the City Council President, Boston City Council. She joins us every month. Thank you again for coming in. Coming up, we're asking about what the, Jim Browdy just asked the Council President. Grudges. Do you hold on to them or can you let them go? That is next on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to Frontline's Michael Kirk about an hour ago, about his new documentary, Supreme Revenge, that airs tonight, which looks at how Robert Bork's failed Supreme Court nomination in the 80s started a 30-year partisan grudge match and created the conservative court we have today and may have for years to come. It delves into McConnell's obsession with getting revenge on the Democrats for tanking Bork's nomination. It's really an anatomy of the grudge and how destructive a grudge can be. So we're taking your calls at 877-301-8970, asking you, are you like Mitch McConnell? Do you let a grudge take over your life? Or are you good at letting them go? Like Andrea Campbell said, she has become, if you can let go of a grudge, how do you do it? How do you manage a grudge that someone holds against you? The number is 877-301-8970. You know how I do it, by the
way? How do you do it, Jim?
I decide. I have a number of grudges. I know that'll shock you. I have a number of grudges. I imagine them. I sort of put my hands out and I say, does this grudge spark joy? And if it does, I keep it. And since they all spark joy, I keep them all. The point of this article in the New York Times by Tim Herrera on May 19th is it is psychologically debilitating to hold grudges. And
yes,
he has this a four-step program about how to dump it. I think that it is ridiculous. By the way, I'd like to drop most of the grudges I have, too. Mm-hmm. But this notion, this simple four-step formula, which we can get into in a minute, to me is preposterous. I mean, it's just not
working.
Well,
you know what helped me drop my grudges?
No.
Because you realize that when you hold a grudge against person A, and it eats you up, and you're full of the anger, you are raging at that person A. But you know what? Person A couldn't care less about you. Person A is occupying all this space in your head.
That's true.
And you're being driven insane by them, and they're indifferent to you. So it's kind of like, why am I obsessing over a person that doesn't give two dams about
me? Okay, before we take the calls, Marjorie, you and I suffer. We're not going to get into details at all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in another workplace, we were really, really, really screwed by an individual. Do
That's
you know what
right.
I'm talking about?
Okay. That's right.
Now, I have not forgotten that. You apparently have. So here's the four part. The first tactic is to calm yourself down in the moment.
Yeah.
Were you able to calm yourself down in that moment?
I think I was marginally upset about it at the time.
Marginally upset.
Okay, I was livid.
Okay, you were livid.
I
That's
livid.
Number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, were you able to shift how you think and talk about the source of your grudge? Quote, were you able to change your story from that of a victim to a more heroic story?
Well, I don't know if I ever get to the heroic point, but I would say I was better than you in this regard.
Well, that's not much.
I mean, you were plotting. You had a lot of
I still am
schemes.
Plotting. I still am plotting. It was many years ago. I will never forget. And by the way, I am grown up enough, barely.
I remember what you told me you were going to do.
I have to do. If you say that on the air, I am literally walking out of here.
Let me just tell you this, Jim. It was insane. I just want you to know.
And it may be criminal in some states. I'm not sure.
I think criminal in all states.
Okay, fine. And you were going to come with me until you got scared you'd be arrested for it. But in any case, putting that aside for a second, I am grown up enough to realize mm-hmm. that it does eat away at you.
It does.
That person does occupy space in your head and your body.
You think he thinks about you, Jim?
No.
I think, exactly.
But he was thinking about me. He or she was thinking about me on that particular day.
That's right. After he screwed you. But that's.
And he's going to think of me again, let me tell you. Let me just be clear. I don't know when. I don't know where.
Okay.
But he is going to think of me again.
And so you want to see that look of horror come across his face when he sees
maybe
you coming.
Do.
Okay.
In any case, we want to know what your relationship to grudge. Everybody's held a grudge. Do you? I mean, I loved Andrea Campbell's answer. She said she used to have a problem with it. She's gotten better at it over time. Her husband has helped her. You contend you are better at it. I don't mm-hmm. know about that. I am not better at it. But we'll hear what people have to say. 877-301-897. Let's start in Hyde Park with our buddy Bernier. Hey, Bernier, how are you?
How are you?
Excellent.
I think... are you holding a grudge now?
Well, I might hold one against you, depending on the quality of the call. So let's see, Bernier. Go ahead.
I think I am someone who... Well, let's define grudge. Isn't grudge something that you hold against someone and you cannot forgive them? Isn't that what grudge
is? Yes, exactly. That's right.
Okay. So I am generally inclined to believe that the opposite of love is not hatred, it's indifference.
Exactly.
So when somebody does something, when somebody does something to me, I am generally indifferent. However, I'm sort of a grudge holder a la carte.
What does that mean?
If I sense that person would repeat the same thing if I forgive them, then I will force myself to hold a grudge so to protect myself.
That's great.
Oh, okay. That's reasonable.
That's great.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
But you know,
I don't hold grudges yet.
Okay, so you're another healthy person like Andrea Campbell and allegedly like Marjorie. But we just talked to Michael Kirk about a man, the most powerful Republican on Capitol Hill, Mitch McConnell, who's held a grudge for 30 years, and only because he's held that grudge was he able to defeat a moderate appointee like Merrick Garland and able to ensure that Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh are on the Supreme Court for the next 30 years of our lives. So would you not argue in that case holding a grudge worked?
Well, I think Mitch McConnell, first of all, I would not consider him as part of the human race, so he's a totally different person.
Well, you and Marjorie are in the same boat. Hey, Bernier, thanks. I like that that grudge a la carte. I mean,
I like that.
That's a good philosophy.
Absolutely.
If you think they're going to repeat the same misbehavior, then don't forgive. Don't continue to hold the grudge. I think that's a good approach.
Now, Paul says that you need to let go of a grudge so you can plot a proper revenge without being distracted.
Well, that's called holding a grudge. I mean, if you decide you're plotting revenge.
Without being clouded by anger. I got that wrong. You can plot your revenge without being clouded by anger. Robert says, to this day, I have not forgiven Jim for cutting in front of me at the service department at George Gray's Lexington Toyota. You do that, Jim?
I might have.
You might have. Okay. And Paul also says, anger is a poison we drink hoping others will die.
You know, that guy, what's the name of the guy who mentioned the George Gray service?
Robert.
He's been texting us about that for like 15 years. And so... Talk about holding a grudge. He's never getting over that.
He said, to this day, I left out this part, to this day, as you can tell from my emails.
Okay, fine. He's an honest
man. He says he hasn't forgotten. Yes. And Paul also said, forgiveness is not about giving someone a pass or trusting someone who will screw you again. It's about forgiving yourself for letting someone take your personal power and for giving yourself permission to let go.
Well, that is totally mature. And that is, I understand intellectually that's the way to go. I'm just not quite there yet.
Okay.
Jenny in a car, you're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Excellent, thank you.
Good. So I'm a longtime listener and a monthly supporter, and I wanted to tell you, Jim, that I have a 10-carat grudge, and I'm keeping it forever. did you take that quiz? You can take a quiz. I don't know if it's the Washington Post or the New York Times where you can take a quiz and it will rate your grudge.
They do.
No, I didn't read that in the story.
I think it's in that story. Yeah. It's at the end, right?
Yeah. At the end, you can get your grudge rated by how intentional it was, whether it was a big deal or a little deal. And mine was a 10-carat grudge because I hit all the boxes.
And so what did you do about it?
It changed my life. I was treated so badly, my family and I, by people that we considered very good friends. And it changed my life because while I will never get rid of my grudge, it really made me examine my everyday behavior. And it has made me, from that day forward, go out of my way to be kind to people. Wow. And to treat people as well as I possibly can in any situation. And to reach out to people who, you know, lost somebody or whatever, because to be treated so terribly just made me feel like this is what life is all about. And I never want to be a person who hurts somebody. And that was pretty intentional, but, you know, in any way, just negligently or without thinking about it. So it changed my life for the better, but I'll never get rid of my grudge and I'll never forgive that person. Just couldn't do it.
Well, you sort of, you're doing a bifurcated.
Yeah, bifurcated.
Your ability, which I don't have the same ability, is to continue holding the grudge and grow like you appear to have. That is an uplifting story, Jenny, about your transformation as a result. Thanks for sharing it with us. Can you do that? Can you hold a grudge and, based upon that mistreatment, allow yourself to grow like she described? I mean, that was really an impressive call.
I don't know. I'll have to think about that when I have a little bit more time to contemplate it, Jim.
So do you still have a grudge? Let's get back. Do you still have a grudge against the person I was talking about?
No, I don't.
You really do not?
I do not. It was a long time ago, Jim. It was a very long time ago.
Now, let me ask you one other thing.
Uh-huh.
Had I not been able, and I think it was mostly I, mm-hmm. had I not been able to fix the malevolent act that was directed at us, do you think you'd still hold a grudge?
Yes.
Okay. So essentially, the only
reason... I would have had to sell my house and move to Brockton or Chelsea or Fall River, my hometown.
Okay, fine.
I would have been destitute. So I would have been a little upset.
No more
about
details.
That.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Paul's on a roll today.
What did he say?
He has a grudge against a kid who stuffed Mitch McConnell in a locker in second grade and started him on the road to being a jerk.
You know, in all seriousness, when you see Mitch McConnell now, do you not feel that that's what happened to him as a kid, like a locker
something,
stuffing kind of
something
experience?
Something happened.
Some slight
something
like
happened.
That.
But he claims none of it bothers him, the ridicule of him, the hatred of him.
Yeah, I don't find
Saturday
don't
Night
that.
Live saying he looks like a turtle, all these unkind things.
Well, that's, I don't
he
buy
claims
I don't like that kind of
it
thing.
It doesn't bother him at all.
Sarita, I hope I pronounced it right. You're in Newton. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. We're talking about grudges.
Well, and I thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
One is, do you think you can be an effective long-term politician if you don't hold grudges?
No.
That's one.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. That's not a good thing, I don't think. And the other thing is my method for dealing with people who against whom I could really hold a grudge, for the vast majority of my personal affronts, I forget. I just put it out of my mind. I mean, I deal with it. I think about it. But I put it out of my mind.
Well, how do you do that? Wait, don't leave. How do you just...
No.
How do you put it out of your mind?
Nope.
I'd love to put some of these out of my mind.
So,
how do you do it?
As a senior medical student, I went to Johns Hopkins to interview in medicine and surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the surgeons would be the ones who would nail the windows shut and have me open them, but by the end of the day, they'd offer me a job.
Uh-huh.
The next day, I went to the medicine people, and they were so dismissive and so rude. And one man in particular, and then at the end of the interview, he basically said, you know, you got to know I'm not going to recommend you for a spot for, you know, internal medicine as an intern next year. And I said, well, thank you for your candor. And I stood up to leave, and he goes, well, have you had any other offers? And I said, well, I have. And he said, well, do you mind if I ask what they are? And I said, no, I don't. And I made him ask, and I whipped off all these places that were really great. And I said, actually, yesterday I said I was offered a job here as a surgical intern. And he goes, oh, well, that changes things. And I said, well, it doesn't change anything for me. I know you're a busy man. And I went up to the secretary's office. I said, you can cancel my interviews for the rest of the day because I've seen everything I need to see. And I, to this day, I can't remember his name. I only remember he had red hair. And I just,
forget. I mean, I forget whole events that are particularly insulting because why keep it in your brain and waste that space?
Exactly.
You know?
That's it. It's keeping it in your brain and wasting the space. The thing
but Sarita dealt well with him. I mean, she beat him.
But the other thing is, if you didn't beat him, the thing that drives me crazy about keeping these grudges is to be thinking about someone constantly.
I know, you're right.
That doesn't think of me for 2 seconds. I don't want that because that person is winning. I'm not winning.
I got it.
They're winning.
Sarita, can I ask you one last thing? If you had not had all those other opportunities, would you think you would have been as able to drop the grudge as you were?
Oh, hell yeah.
Wow, you were another grown-up person.
Occupy my mind.
Sarita, I mean, you sound great.
If you mess with my family, you're in big trouble.
I wouldn't, frankly. Sarita, thank you very much. That was a fabulous call. We appreciate it.
By the way, this is all supposed to be bad for your immune system, Jim.
I know it is.
Dysregulate your nervous system, cardiovascular system. You could be falling apart at any moment.
Well, when you're really angry, and anger is obviously a part of holding a grudge, don't you feel like you're going to have a stroke on the spot? You really do.
Yes. Some of us don't get as angry.
No, but
as
yeah,
often
can I tell you what?
People.
No, I want to say in my defense, because you've been critical of me like you always are, is this incident that we talked about happened maybe a decade or so ago?
A decade.
I don't think of
I
it.
I thought it was 20
okay,
years.
Okay, so let's say it's 10, 12 years, whatever. I don't think of it more than, you know, 5 or 6 times a day. So it isn't like I haven't freed myself. There are whole half hours that go by that I'm not thinking about this person. So
okay.
I'm a little healthier than you think I am.
Okay. Tim from Worcester.
But I just want to be clear. But I want to be clear about this.
What do you want to be clear about, Jim?
I'm about to tell you. Yep. Even though Marjorie is like, you know, doing this cavalier, I've gone past it. I'm not going to let this guy occupy.
That's right.
I'm not going to let this guy occupy my mind. You admitted, had I not fixed the problem while you were like a puddle of goo because of it, that you wouldn't be able to get over it. So you're only able to get over it because it was rectified through no action of his part, by the way.
Hey, Jim, I always say that I knew you would. You're very good at fixing these situations, and I'm eternally grateful.
Yeah.
Because I am not able
okay,
to do it.
We could just leave it there, by the
way.
Marjorie said, I'm very good at fixing these situations.
Yep.
And let me just say to that person, if he happens to be listening today, never forget... Never surrender. Need I say more?
Exactly. I would say if he sees the Jim Browdy walking
toward
him,
my God.
He should call 911 immediately.
I'm going to work on it. I am going to work on it. No, you don't have to call 911, but in any case.
I don't know. I think you might have to.
Thank you for your
excellent
calls.
Anyway, coming up, we're going to talk with CNN's John King. He's going to go over the latest headlines. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us on the line to go over the latest political headlines is John King. John, of course, is CNN's chief national correspondent. He's the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. And since he's from Dorchester, I am sure he holds grudges. John, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for calling in.
Hello, John King.
I'm trying in my older age to let the grudges go, to be a duck, Jim. Let it just hit and roll off.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
I hope not, John.
So we're watching CNN this morning, John King, as we do every day, and we saw this picture of an empty chair with the name Don McGahn, White House Counsel, on the little nameplate there, and it was empty. And Jerry Nadler, the Democrat, was going on and on about how McGahn has ignored their subpoena to come testify before them. So what happens now? Nadler seemed very upset about it, and so do some of the other Democrats with McGahn.
It's in and of itself, it's an important confrontation, and then it's part of a much bigger debate, Jim and Marjorie, about do you open an impeachment inquiry here? Because the Democrats are increasingly frustrated that every time they ask for anything from the White House, they get a no. So the question is, can they somehow work this out, which appears unlikely at the moment? So the next would be a contempt citation. Then it would probably be you'd have to go to court to try to get your subpoena enforced. Democrats won one round in court yesterday with one federal judge, and that Speaker Pelosi is trying to use as to let's slow down, let's investigate, let's air out the facts in these hearings, let's not rush to impeachment. But more and more Democrats, including people loyal to the Speaker, close to the Speaker, are saying, you know what, if they're going to keep saying no, we should at least open an impeachment inquiry. maybe not say we're definitely going to impeach, but start a proceeding, because history does tell us that that if you have an open impeachment proceeding, it has a higher constitutional power, if you will. It has a higher power under the law than, say, you know, Richie Neal, your chairman from Massachusetts, saying, I want the president's taxes. So we'll see if it gets there. Speaker Pelosi has managed this pretty deftly so far, but she's starting to get nudged a little closer, and it's a fascinating question.
So I assume the argument being made by those on her leadership team who say we have to at least start impeachment hearings is we look like fools. I mean, the president is basically thwarting every opportunity for us to exercise our constitutional mandate. And what do we do other than whine? Is her response to that purely a political response, that he's trying to goad us into this, it's going to hurt us down the line, let the individual committees do whatever it is they're doing? What's her response to her recalcitrant leaders?
Her response is twofold, and part of it is the political argument you make, that, and she has a pretty strong one there in her view. Again, there are people out there who would disagree, but her view would be, look at the 2016 presidential election. It was all about Trump, and Hillary Clinton lost. Mm-hmm. Look at the 2018 midterm elections. It was a lot about Trump, but it was also about health care. It was also about other things, and we won. And if we have an impeachment, it's going to become all about Trump, and we're not going to be able to talk about health care. We're not going to be able to talk to the people who are out there who, yes, might have 4% unemployment or less, but are working two jobs or are worried about their health care. So she's nervous that it would just give the president a they're out to get me, it's all about Trump message. She does have a process argument, Jim, and again, she's starting to lose some people close to her in that, you know, impeachment should be a last resort, and there should be an incredibly high bar. And it is the position of most Democrats that, you know, Bill Clinton should not have been impeached, that not defending what he did, but that it was not that personal conduct and personal mistakes, personal failings should not have risen to the level of impeachment. That's their case if you go back 25 years. However, again, whether it's a subpoena for the president's taxes, a subpoena for the president's financial records, a subpoena for witnesses to come in and talk further about the Mueller report, when the answer is no, 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 there are a lot of other Democrats saying they leave us no choice. And I think this is going to be interesting to watch. I'm going to say for the next week or two to see if the Democrats can win a couple more rounds in court or get a couple of witnesses in the chair. Maybe it takes the air out of the balloon a little bit. But otherwise, the pressure is mounting.
But one of the things I don't understand, John, and maybe you can help me out with this, with Pelosi's argument. I mean, I get the one about, you know, the president's not worth it. It's going to be all about impeachment. But it's not as if the House is able to do much anyway, because whatever they put forward, they're not going to get through the Senate. Meanwhile, the presidential candidates are all out there talking about health care and student debt and all these things. So it's not as if right now we're getting a lot of headlines out of the House on their efforts to change things about health care, et cetera. You know what I mean?
But she does have, Marjorie, 25 members. Maybe it's 20. Maybe it expands to 30. But somewhere in that ballpark of members who are from vulnerable districts,
yep,
who do want to be able to go home and look their voters in the eye and say, we at least passed it in the House, and we screened at the Senate, but they wouldn't listen to us, and the Republican Senate would not pass this, but I tried.
Okay.
To at least to be able to go home and make the case that I tried. I wasn't all about impeachment, because especially those who come from districts that the president carried, you do not, you know, they have those members. And the interesting part, though, to your point, is even more of those members are starting to say, I might be okay, or I'm getting closer to being okay with opening an impeachment inquiry. And that tells you they're feeling enough of their supporters back home, or if they're in a very difficult decision, it's a hard call for them, because if you have some Democratic base voters, more liberal voters in your district, but you also have to win some Trump voters to hold your seat, you know, who do you answer to here? Because will the base voters not turn out for you? And you might not get those Trump voters in a presidential election year anyway. So it's really delicate for about 20, 25 members of the House. And that's what Pelosi's trying to navigate more than the safe Democrats, you know, the people who are from districts who are going to win either way. And it's a hard one.
Well, let me ask you just one quick last question along those lines. What precludes them from doing something on health care while they're doing something opening an impeachment inquiry or whatever they want to do.
Nothing. You're absolutely right. Nothing precludes them. They just don't think they'll get any attention.
Okay.
In part, I'll take this. You know, I'll speak as a sinner here. What do you think my business, cable television,
CNN? Impeachment.
I think CNN would be a little bit better than the other guys who are more political than we are. But what do you think is going to dominate cable television?
Okay.
You know, and so it's not going to break through.
So, John, at the end of your show, speaking of McGahn not showing up, there was a headline suggesting that Mueller, who doesn't have a date yet, also may not show up, or at least he's being encouraged by his teammates, his special counsel teammates, to not show up. Could you break that down for us a little bit? What's going on?
I'll break it down to the degree I can. Our justice team was first to report this, and now you see it in other places as well, that there are negotiations underway, and Mueller's team, we have not heard from Mueller himself, but let's assume Mueller runs a tight ship and he's an ex-Marine and the ex-FBI director, that his team speaks for him, is saying that, you know, they're reluctant to have a ton of public testimony. And I think there was one initial position that they don't want any public testimony, that they want to do this behind closed doors. Look, you know this. I mean, he's going to get asked things by Republicans, of course, to say to go through the no collusion part of it. And he's going to get asked things like Democrats, like, here, this is the letter the Attorney General Bill Barr, your friend, wrote about your report. Is it anywhere close, in your view, to being factual or contextual? And so he's worried about the special counsel is worried and his team is worried about being drawn into what we have playing out before us, which is a very fierce, nasty political debate. The point I try to make in the show is that the people listening, the people in Boston, the people in Omaha, the people around the country, you paid for this. It is inconceivable to me, whatever your opinion, whoever you voted for, whoever you support, that after spending tens of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money over 2 years, that the guy who headed the investigation, he should be required to testify publicly at least once. No, but they're negotiating.
You know, this is going to sound so naive, almost embarrassed to say it. I continue to be befuddled by. I know he's a loyal public servant. Everybody raves against Mueller except for with a couple of exceptions. On the most important issue confronting the American people, you did the report and the 2-year analysis. You believe it was misrepresented to the American people, and you're hanging out at your house or at your office and allowing there to be spec. I cannot believe that if a guy who loves his country is this, as much as everybody says this former Marine and straight arrow does, I can't believe he's not volunteering to testify in front of Congress, and I'm there any day you want me to clarify any confusion. I know I am just stunned. And when I heard, read your headline today that he might never be there, it's just incredible to me. I'm done my rant.
I think that's a, you know what, that's not a rant, actually. It's a very well thought out.
I wouldn't go that far.
He's a career public servant. He had to know the stakes. Look, does Bob Mueller wish maybe he hadn't been asked to do this job? I don't know the answer to that question, but I could understand if he was thinking, oh my God, why did I say yes? Or why didn't I go hide in a cave somewhere? But with that responsibility, I think comes the follow-up responsibility of, yes, follow your report, but at least once, take the heat and explain it to the American people. And yes, yeah, I get the idea. I worked in this town for 30 years now. It was never perfect, but it's broken now. And there are some very good people, some very smart people in both parties on these committees. But there's also a lot of clown car stuff going on in both parties and all these committees. And so I get if you're Bob Mueller not wanting to get caught up in the circus. But when you took the job, you knew the circus was going to be a part of it. And so to me, there's just no way out now.
You know, John, can I ask one?
Although the one thing I, because I am not, I do think that there was obstruction of justice from that Mueller report, but I think he's been so obtuse and imprecise about so many things that I think it would be a repeat of the same thing. I mean, he just doesn't seem to be able to say, he's not precise. And
well, I think precise questions engender precise answers.
Well, we'll see. They're not always the best questioners.
John, one more. Maybe you can settle the dispute Marjorie and I were having because it relates earlier today on the show because it relates. I know this is hypothetical. Relates to the whole political argument against impeachment. We were talking about how Boston is this, your hometown, essentially ground to a halt. We have the worst commute in the United States, according to a recent survey. You know, another train derailed today. There's going to be this major construction on the Alston exit for 8 to 10 years, and then we started talking about the infrastructure discussion that Schumer and Pelosi had with the president. They leave. Everybody seems pleased. I think we talked to you about it when it happened a week or so ago, whenever it was. I operate under the assumption, which may be as cynical as the day is long, is we're never going to see it, because just as Nancy Pelosi is worried that impeachment, even if it made sense on the merits, is going to hurt the Democratic nominee in 2020 and maybe other Democrats in 2020, that an infrastructure deal that the president can trumpet as the biggest and boldest and best ever to the tune of $2 trillion is something that the Democrats would never allow him to have, even if the country needs it badly. Am I way off base?
Well, I think if the president came up with a credible way to fund the $2 trillion, he would put the Democrats in a box. I think Speaker Pelosi knows that he won't and can't, and therefore she's not going to have to deal with this question. We're going to get the answer. I was joking about this the other day, that, you know, it's become a punchline in Washington. This is Infrastructure Week. Well, this is the week that we learn if there will be an Infrastructure Week, because remember, we did talk after they met at the White House, and the president embraced the $2 trillion yeah. figure. And then he said, come back in 3 weeks, and I'll have some ideas on how I'm going to pay for it. Since then, his chief of staff and others inside the White House have revolted against the president. And other conservatives outside of the White House are incredibly nervous about the president, because to get to $2 trillion, one of the things you could do, for example, is the Chamber of Commerce, not a Democratic group, it tends to be a Republican-leaning group, says raise the gas tax. Mm-hmm. And they've sent all these proposals, raise the gas tax, other revenue proposals that involve taxes, to the White House. And it's pretty hard to get to $2 trillion without that. Otherwise, it's huge government spending, deficit spending. And, you know, and a lot of conservatives in Congress who have been part of raising the deficit, you know, for the last several years would suddenly howl and claim to be deficit hawks. And so they're going to have a fascinating moment this week. The president, by most accounts, is being pushed by his chief of staff to retreat to something much more modest in the $1 trillion range, and even that would be funded more through these public-private partnerships and loan guarantees and not straight-up federal money, and certainly no revenue increases. I think the Democrats will say that's too small and that requires our cities and states to pay for things. So no, we won't do that, and the whole thing will collapse. That, to me, is the question this week. Does the president defy his own party and his own mm-hmm. chief of staff and his own other people inside the White House and say, no, I want to do this? And we know in his heart he does, actually. Does he defy them and risk a Republican revolt heading into an election year, or does it all collapse? We'll know that in a few days.
Talking to John King from CNN.
So, John, Joe Biden, to repeat the line millions of people have used, I think we did it as well, that the, you know, the best day of his campaign was going to be the first day announced and it was all downhill from there. That certainly hasn't proven to be true. He's still doing very well in many of the key states. He's leading, sometimes dramatically, these polls. I saw the president was in Pennsylvania talking about the great economy he's leading right now. But Biden is beating him in some of these polls.
Including in Pennsylvania, 20 electoral votes, one of those states like Michigan and Wisconsin that the president flipped in 2016 that he has to keep in 2020, at least most of them, to win again. One of the great laboratories, if you're going to watch just one state in 2020, whether it's Biden or not, watch Pennsylvania, and can the Democrats get it back? It's fascinating in the sense that we saw some of this in 2018 where the economy was getting better, but the president's personal numbers were so bad. His approval rating, is he trustworthy, is he honest, do you like the way he conducts business, do you like his tweet? That dragged the president down. The president is convinced, with him on the ticket, that will be different, that with him on the ballot, it will be different than the midterm election. We will see. In the new Quinnipiac poll, 54% of the people of Pennsylvania say they're doing better than they were when Trump became president. They're feeling better about the economy. They're doing better. And yet 54%, the same exact number, disapprove of the president's job mm-hmm. performance. That's because they don't like the personal attributes. As for Biden, look, if Biden himself said the other day, I wish this were a parliamentary system, I'd call quick elections. Because, you know, his numbers have gotten better. You all think your first day is going to be your best day, because Democrats might not love Joe Biden, but they all like Joe Biden and they all respect Joe Biden. His numbers are getting better. And this is forcing all of the other candidates to figure out, what do I do? And for most of them, that means we have, you know, 8.5 months till anybody votes. So for most of those other Democrats, it means do the best you can, raise money, plant your issue flags, and get to the debates. We're going to have two sets of debates, one in June. That's an MSNBC, NBC debate is the June series, then CNN in July. And I would bet we have 23 candidates now. I'm going to guess after that, we lose about a third of them.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to be able to raise money, and they're not going to be able to make the case, you know, whether it's to their own people, whether it's to their staff, whether it's to fundraisers, to stay in the race. So the challenge now is to survive this pre-debate phase. But if you're Joe Biden, you're feeling great about this. That doesn't mean there aren't burdens on you. He better give a, you know, how's he going to explain what is his climate change policy? You have all the candidates waiting to pounce on him if it's not aggressive. When are we going to hear his views on what he says, but we haven't heard in detail, is allow you to buy into Medicare, a public option to buy into Medicare for all if you want, but also spend a lot more time fixing the existing Obamacare, to make that the priority, not a broad Medicare for all. The policy he has to fill out. But if you're Joe Biden right now, you're feeling really happy. And one piece of the evidence there is how much of the president's attention you have.
Exactly. That's well, it's not just the president, and we know he mentioned him in Pennsylvania. The thing that I've talked to Marjorie about, which is why I think his early lead is more significant than just the early lead, is if, other than Elizabeth Warren, who gets a decent amount of press when she does a policy prescription, if you're one of the 22 others and you come out with a policy thing, you'll get an itty-bitty amount of press. If you criticize, I was going to say the president, if you criticize Joe Biden for his position on climate change or he's racing in the middle on X, you're going to get a lot more press. That's good for you in the short run, but it elevates Biden's front-runner status in the long run. I think these other candidates are in a real bind, John, in terms of how to deal with the Biden candidacy and separate yourself from the rest of the pack, don't you think?
Yes, and part of it is readjusting to the notion that a lot of them thought that he would have a great first day and maybe first week, and then people would say it's time for just the people would just decide it's time for something new. Nothing against you, Joe. It's just time for something new. Mm-hmm. That has not happened. And so you have to find your moments. Are people listening to me on the radio? So I doubt many of them are watching CNN. But right now, Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, who has been struggling, is on TV with my colleague Phil Mattingly. She's outside of the Supreme Court. We have these protests going on across the country right now for these state abortion restrictions that are making their way either through the legislatures, or some of them now are still in the legislature. Some of them are now going to end up in court. But so she has seized on this issue, and smartly so. Is it enough to springboard her? I don't know. But it's a smart way. Bernie Sanders is also at this rally at the Supreme Court. Pete Buttigieg stopped by. Amy Klobuchar was there. Several of the presidential candidates have stopped by this rally because they're trying to get, if you will, just a little, you know, get a moment. And I think that's all you can hope for right now. But my bigger question is, if Biden does not stumble on his own, somebody at one of these debates is going to turn on him. Now, we know Bernie Sanders will on NAFTA and on the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Will the other candidates make a run at Joe Biden? Because it's a huge risk. Because, again, he might not be your candidate out there if you're listening and you're a Democrat, but most Democrats like him, respect him for his career anyway, but for 8 years as Barack Obama's vice president. And so a Democrat who goes mean on Joe Biden might have the effect of knocking Biden down a notch or two, but you might take yourself out too. And so it's a dangerous bet.
One last thing from me, John. When you mentioned Buttigieg, it made me think of his performance at Fox Town Hall and
standing
taking
on
Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson and getting a virtual standing O. But also, I was reading a story on the CNN site earlier this morning about the president's plans, possibly on Memorial Day, to pardon a couple of people who have been accused of war crimes. And while it was troubling enough to me, particularly since we had the guy on our show yesterday, Steve Kerrigan, who was leading the effort to put 37,000 flags on the common to honor those men and women who have died in combat from Massachusetts through our wars. Then I read that there's a Fox News weekend co-host who's been lobbying the president to do these pardons. Did I get the story right?
Yes, Pete Hegseth of Fox and Friends, who's a veteran himself, has been lobbying the president to do this. That's one particular president gets a lot of his ideas from people on that particular network, even though he's mad at it right now. He ranted against them last night at his rally in Pennsylvania because they put Pete Buttigieg and the other, they're putting the Democrats on TV. That was pretty striking to watch. There's a little dysfunction in the relationship, if you will. Yes, that is something the president's considering, and it's quite controversial. And what's been interesting to me is to watch a number, we had a couple on our air yesterday, watch a number of Army veterans and military veterans say that it's a bad idea. One of the particular cases, like the whole squad turned some guy in because they thought what happened was abhorrent.
And they went up the chain of command and nobody did anything. That was what was really upsetting, too, that it seemed like that was almost a conspiracy.
Yeah, and so that is that. To your Buttigieg point, Jim, look, he has taken Beto O'Rourke's space, if you will, as the if we're looking for a totally new, outside-the-box, new face in the Democratic Party. That's what Beto O'Rourke thought would be his space, and he's trying to recalibrate himself. Now all the Democrats have to sort of reboot because, A, of the success of Buttigieg to a point, and I'll get to the point in a minute, and B, just because Biden has not done what they thought he was going to do. He's gone up instead of coming down some. But even if you're Buttigieg, again, the guy used a CNN town hall to launch his national name ID. Then he does a Fox town hall. He's traveling the country. He's textbook smart, if you will, and moving it around. It's an interesting and compelling personal story, both the fact that he's a gay American who travels with his husband, but also that he served in the military. He's a mayor from a red state. Every piece of his personal story is interesting. And yet he's at 15, you know, he's at 8% in some polls, 10% or 12% in other polls. So even he, 15 maybe in some. But even though he has come up, you know, he's still 15 is ceiling right now. How do you get above that? Bernie is at 18 or 20 or 15, and Biden's in the 30s. So the race is in a really interesting place. Nobody votes for a long time, but you'd much rather be Joe Biden in the driver's seat than the guys in the back trying to figure out, and the girls in the back, excuse me, the men and women in the back, trying to figure out, how do I crack through here?
Yeah.
It's fun to watch.
It is fun to watch, and it's fun to talk to you. John,
thanks
as always.
John, thank you so much.
John Take care, guys. See you next week.
You too. John King joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon. We watch it here every day. And Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Coming up, Robert F. Smith is paying off $40 million of student loan debt for the class of 2019 at Morehouse College. Don't you wish your kid was in the class of 2019 at Morehouse College? Anyway, is this philanthropy at its best or not? Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane joins us for that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie and live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. David Foster Wallace, George Sanders, Oprah Winfrey, Steve Jobs, they're all in the commencement address canon for inspiring people far beyond the college campus. But did Robert F. Smith set a new precedent for what a graduation speech can do?
On behalf of the eight generations of my family who have been in this country, we're going to put a little fuel in your bus. Now, I've got the alumni over there, and this is a challenge to you, alumni. This is my class, 2019. And my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
Within a matter of seconds, Smith eliminated $40 million worth of debt. But did he also help to eliminate the burden of fixing the institutional problems that create this kind of debt in the first place? Is he setting a great example or a well-intended but horrible precedent? Joining us for her take on this is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hello, Nancy Kane.
Hey there.
So, which is it? This is a wonderful piece of philanthropy, but... is this the way things are supposed to happen?
Well, it's the way... So I think it's both and, as a therapist would say. This is a both and situation. Philanthropy is not new. The disgruntlement that has immediately arisen around Robert Smith's completely unexpected gift in Morehouse College, which is known as a highly black college and university, right? It's black students. They, I think, graduated one white person in the last 5 years. And it's male, all male. And it dates back, dear listeners, to 1867. There were former slaves involved in its founding. It was designed to be a theological and school of theology and education. So it's a very interesting storied institution. Martin Luther King got his AB or BA from that institution. So his gift was a surprise, complete surprise. I actually know the president of Morehouse College, David Thomas, who's a friend of mine because he taught at the business school for a great long time.
Wow.
Terrific man. He left 2 years ago to be the president of Morehouse College, and he called it a huge gift of liberation for the school and for students. So the best knowledge we have is that Smith decided in the last 24 hours of the speech to do this, right? Having read something about the $1.5 trillion that American students have chalked up in higher education debt. And he did it. And it's going to change, undoubtedly, the lives of 397 graduates, yeah. right? And those lives will have, they will have more freedom. They will have, they may, many of them may have a renewed sense or a deeper sense of obligation, them having had this helping hand. By the way, dear listeners, the gift does not forgive or eliminate debt that parents accrued. So it's for student, right, student-named debt, $40 million worth. And it's going to be a very complicated thing to figure out how to discharge this gift. But this happened, right? Lives were made better. Hope was added. More freedom was given. And the possibilities, the ripple effects of this, I think, are tremendous, like lots of great acts of philanthropy, like lots of large acts of philanthropy. At the same time, right, the objections, or I should say the criticisms of this, which immediately popped up, were, wait a minute, this is, and the New York Times today, dear listeners, has an editorial about this, saying this is primarily, should be viewed primarily as a failure of public policy, right?
Yeah.
And then it goes
well,
on.
Well, it is. I mean, that's
well,
hard to
it
dispute.
It is. Just like GoFundMe, right, the online crowdsourcing financing device, which, by the way, has raised $5 billion, a third of which is for health care, is about, at some level, scratch the surface, a failure in the American government's ability to provide affordable health care for most of its citizens. So, yes, and yes, then the Times goes on. What about Andrew Carnegie, right? These were, you know, robber barons who made their money maybe illicitly, maybe legitimately, and they weren't taxed very high because there was no federal income tax until the second decade of the 20th century. And they gave them, and Carnegie gave all those libraries and did a whole lot of other things with his money. So we can. This argument is not new, and it is important. And it opens up these gifts, open up the conversation. I don't want us to lose sight of something that in this toxic time is so easy to fall out of our field of vision, which is. This is also a source of credible, and what Peter Gomes, the minister for a long time at Harvard Business School, would call buoyant hope. And we don't, that sits alongside the failure of public policy.
But what's that great line you used at the beginning of this? You talked about what shrinks say. What was that?
Both and.
Yeah, well, both and.
It's a both and situation.
I mean, yes. One, you got to be like a misanthrope to not celebrate Smith's generosity. However,
Hold on. Can you imagine? It only goes to the kids. So can you imagine if mom and dad took the whole load on
right.
themselves and
the,
said,
yeah.
you, Johnny, you go ahead. Don't worry
Absolutely.
About it. And then
yeah, no.
Johnny could have gotten it all
also
forgiven
great.
In the past.
For those of us who have watched the video about 3,000 times,
yeah.
you can see there's a pause where their kids are not 100% sure
it's
what
real.
He said.
Yeah.
But let me just say, we've had this discussion before. What's the name of the guy who wrote the great book about philanthropists pretending that they're solving the world's problems?
Anon-Hieronymus?
Yeah, we had him on the show. He was right. great. You can celebrate the benevolence and mm-hmm. the generosity of philanthropists.
Yeah.
And also, this is the thing you mentioned, yeah. the two ends or the both ends, whatever, say in some ways it does mask. It is a public policy failure, as the New York Times editorial said, for the 2 million kids in college who are not lucky enough to be over
right.
there at Morehouse yesterday, they're not celebrating. And the horror of this is, and this is the fault of the media, Robert Smith will get more publicity for his incredible generosity mm-hmm. for days and days than will Elizabeth Warren's plan,
right.
whether you like it or not, to eliminate student debt and to make public colleges and universities free, because that's the nature of the beast.
It
so
is.
If
and
this inspires a larger debate, yep. fabulous. But if not, it should be seen as what it is, an incredibly generous, wonderful act for these 400
so
young men.
I think I agree, Jim. And I want to say, I need to add, again, like we only read the headlines because we're so fractured and there's so much coming at us and there's so much. So many big things unfolding right now for all of us. We're also exhausted, right? And many of us are on news diets, but we don't always get underneath, right, the surface. So let me just do that. That's what historians are supposed to be doing. We're not always doing such a good job of it. But let me just read you. This is what he said at the commencement. This guy's interesting, by the way.
Very interesting.
Let me just say a word about Robert Smith, for those of you that don't know anything about him. I know just what I've learned in the last few days. So he is, let me say, 56 years old. He was born in Denver to two African-American high school teachers who had PhDs. He was born in a black, poorer section. You just had this city councilwoman chair
Andrea
the,
Campbell,
talking
yeah.
about schools. He was born, and he was bused, right? We're trying to keep that, reduce busing in lots of parts of Boston. He was bused to a predominantly white, much better school, Carson Elementary, and he said it changed his life. He said, I discovered three things. One, the joy of a broad education that included art and English as well as science and math. I discovered that Jewish kids, Asian kids, Latino children and black children and white children, we're all basically kind of the same. And I discovered that if you used your mind and worked hard and dedicated yourself to something that you really wanted to excel, at which you really wanted to excel, you could make a difference. So that's interesting, right? And by the way, just for you, I couldn't resist this. He's a music lover, so he owns one of Elton John's pianos. He named two of his children, second marriage, Hendrix and Legend, after John Legend and Jimi Hendrix.
John Legend performed at his wedding.
At his second wedding.
Yeah.
And he has,
why not?
And he has a rich history of philanthropy, mostly very much under the radar, including big donations to the U.S. African-American Museum of African-American History and Culture. And he recently bought, I noticed that one of Dr. Martin Luther King's daughters tweeted this. He recently bought two of King's homes, the home he grew up in and was born in, and the home he lived in with his children and his family, Coretta Scott King, his wife, and he gave them to the National Park Service. So this guy's interesting.
Very.
And this is not a new gesture on his part. It's just getting a lot of publicity. So that's the first thing he said. The second thing he said, let me read you this at the commencement address. Let me read you this. The degree you earn today is one of the most elite credentials that America has to offer. But I don't want you to think of it as a document that hangs on a wall and reflects what you've accomplished up till now. No, that degree is a contract, a social contract, that calls on you to devote your talents and energies to honoring those legends on whose shoulders you and I stand. And then he said later in the speech, success has many parents. He's trying to do something that's more than a publicity gig, by a long shot. And we don't want to miss that piece either while it unfolds in a legitimate debate about why philanthropy is filling in the gaps of a dysfunctional national government.
I think that's true.
I think that's absolutely true. So let's talk about the big picture.
Yeah.
You mentioned Carnegie earlier, but that was in the New York Times editorial. It struck me that it said that the reason he had so much money to build all these libraries, many of which are still standing today, yep. because there was no income tax then.
Tell that story, by the way. I didn't even know about it until I read that he funded the creation of how many libraries was this?
1,689 yeah. libraries wow. across the United States, so, many still in use.
And let me just add, Ulysses, when he died, there was like $900 in the estate because he'd given it all away.
Yeah.
Good for him.
But it does strike me as interesting, full circle kind of thing, that really there are a lot of billionaires that aren't taxed today,
yep.
really, even though they do have income taxes.
Yep.
Oprah gave everybody a car, so
yeah.
I mean, there is no...
The Times points out that he benefits, he makes his money, dear listeners, he's made most of his money running a private equity company, very, very successful, mm. and most successful in the
Robert
country,
Smith.
Called Vista Equity Partners in California, doing a lot of high-tech stuff.
Yep.
They benefit enormously, he benefits enormously from something called the carried interest loophole, mm-hmm. which says that what you make on investments that you actually engage in for the people that invest in your fund, you get to keep that at lower tax rates, 20% versus 37%, than you would if it was ordinary income. So,
do you know who works very hard to protect that particular tax break, since many of our listeners only rail against Donald Trump and his allies? Chuck Schumer
yeah.
is the
right,
primary
well, because of his ties to the finance industry.
I understand.
Yeah,
I'm
Street.
Just saying.
Right.
That
yeah. so again, that argument can obtain here, too. Excuse
yeah.
me.
Okay.
Can we get back to the larger issues you started to talk about? The issue is not as beautiful as this gesture was at Morehouse, and it was beautiful. And as I said yesterday in the air, if you've not seen interviews of the individual students,
there's,
I've probably seen
who talking,
four or five.
Yeah, they're amazing.
It is as beautiful and heartbreakingly wonderful as anything. Having said that, it should be you know what you should ask these 400 people to do in addition to paying it forward? Join a lobbying force to advance the notion that we have Gina Raimondo on tomorrow that's mm-hmm. making 2-year colleges and I think 4-year colleges soon or now in Rhode Island free. That's got to be dealt with. Extinguishing or reducing debt has got to be dealt with. Bringing down the obscene cost of college to begin with is got to be dealt with. And again, I hope this just spurs that conversation and gets more attention on proposals, not just Warren's. Warren's one of a number of candidates who's done this. This is after mortgages. I assume everybody listening knows the single largest personal debt issue in the United States, $1.5 trillion.
Twice as big as credit card debt.
And by the way, the other thing, I want to say one last thing. I don't mean to ramble endlessly, but Jim, why don't you do it anyway? The worst thing to me is not the inability to buy the car you want or buy the house as quickly as you want, which a lot of people lay out. Yep. We've had callers through the years, Marjorie, 20 years we've been on the radio. So many young people who had to choose a career that was not the one where their heart and passion was, because they couldn't afford to pay off their student debt.
You can't afford to be a social worker. You can't afford to be a teacher.
Harvard Business School has all kinds of socially, you know, very conscious people who say, I can't afford, I have $150,000 in debt. I can't go to Teach for America or I can't go to this environmental public interest
group. So fix it. Now teachers have some sort of loan forgiveness, some public service thing have it. We got to expand that,
Jim,
and hopefully this kicks it off.
Since you've rambled on for so long,
we're
out of time.
Well, that was my
Harvard historian Nancy Kane was here to talk, but she didn't get much of a chance. But that's okay. She holds the James E. Robinson Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, thank you very much. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you to people who came down to the Boston Public Library.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it when you turn up. You can catch us by way.
We do.
24/7 by way of our podcast, which is on iTunes. Tomorrow, we're going to have our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, WGBH Executive Arts Editor, Jared Bowen, Rhode Island Governor, Gina Raimondo, for all you people down in Rhode Island. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our on-site engineer is Ron Milton. Special thanks to Newsfeed Cafe, Jim Browdy. What's on television
Well, before
tonight?
You do that, since you mentioned Governor Raimondo tomorrow, and on Thursday, the following day, Governor Baker is here 1 to 2, and on Friday, the mayor joins us from 12:15 to 1, so hopefully do that. Well, since I couldn't get you to agree that Kamala Harris's proposal about fining companies that don't engage in pay equity was a good idea, we're having a debate about it tonight. Shirley Leung from The Globe, Tina Opie from Babson College are going to debate that. Michael Kirk, who talked to us about this brilliant must-see documentary about the Supreme Court and revenge, who was with us on the radio, is going to continue the discussion with me. And Arun Rath, you're going to be into this, Marjorie, is going to give us an update on the first X number of months of the legal marijuana industry in Massachusetts.
Going gangbusters, I understand, Jim.
Okay, then.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
And Marjorie's a major contributor.
You,
I'm Jim Brown.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in
See
again
tomorrow.
Have a wonderful afternoon.